Dove Audio presents Sky Masters by Dale Brown. Tell me this is some April Fool's joke, sir, Lieutenant Colonel Patrick McClanahan said to Brigadier General John Ormack. And with all due respect, of course, I'll beat your face in. John Ormack, the deputy commander of the High Technology Aerospace Weapons Center, nicknamed Hawk, the Air Force's most secret flight test center, didn't have to look at the wide grin on McClanahan's face to know that he wasn't seriously threatening anyone.
No joke, Patrick, Ormack said. Don't ask me how, but General Elliott got one of the first B-2A test articles assigned to his Strategic Air Reserve fleet here at Dreamland.
But they just made the B-2 operational, McClanahan pointed out. They don't have that many out there. What are we doing with one?
Knowing the boss, he put the squeeze on Systems Command to begin more advanced weapons tests on the B-2, in case they begin full-scale deployment, Ormack replied. I know he was pushing the shift from nuclear to conventional strategy, Ormack went on. It was hard to sell the B-2 as a conventional weapons platform, that is, until Brad Elliott spoke up. He wants to turn this B-2 into another mega-fortress, a flying battleship. Of course, we needed a senior project officer with bomber experience, a warped imagination, and a real bulldog attitude. Naturally, we thought of Patrick McClanahan.
McClanahan was speechless, which made Ormack smile even more. Ormack was an Air Force Academy graduate, although he was a command pilot with several thousand hours flying time. He was more at home in a laboratory or in front of a computer console. It was refreshing to work with someone like Patrick. McClanahan was unlike anyone else at the High Technology Aerospace Weapons Center. He wasn't an Academy grad, not an engineer, not a test pilot. He was simply a hard-working, efficient aviator. McClanahan was the best radar bombardier in the United States, demonstrated by long lines of trophies he'd received in annual exercises in his 6 years as a B-52 crew member. His prowess with the 40-year-old bomber, lovingly nicknamed the Buff or Strato Pig, had attracted the attention of Hawk's commanding officer, Lieutenant General Brad Elliott, who had brought him to Nevada to develop a mega-fortress, a highly modified B-52 bomber used to flight-test high-tech weapons and stealth hardware. McClanahan had taken the mega-fortress, nicknamed the Old Dog, and its ragtag crew into the Soviet Union to destroy a renegade anti-satellite laser site. Rather than risk discovery for the politically explosive mission, McClanahan had been encouraged to remain at Hawk for a chance to work with the newest aircraft and weapons in the world. The Old Dog mission, one of the events that drove the Soviet Union to Glasnost, had to be buried forever, one way or another. Many career-minded men might have resented the de facto imprisonment. Not Patrick McClanahan. No. Whether it was programming a cockpit computer or managing the unit's snack bar, McClanahan did his work efficiently and professionally. Things began to change quickly. Before the ink was dry on his promotion papers to major, he was promoted to lieutenant colonel. His officer effectiveness reports were routinely endorsed by 4-star generals. One had gone all the way to the Secretary of Defense, Thomas Preston himself. Patrick was now one of the most highly respected program managers in the Department of Defense. With downsizing in all strategic bombardment units, some place had to be designated to keep all these inactive aircraft until they might be needed again. Although most were sent to the Boneyard, a few were secretly sent to Dreamland for research and special missions. The place was the Strategic Air Reserve Group, commanded by General Bradley Elliott. Sarge created an operational unit out of exotic research experiments. Now other Old Dogs were being created. The new Old Dogs collected now included 6 B-52 bombers, 2 B-1 bombers, both original A models, 6 F-111G fighter bombers, and the newest arrival, McClanahan's B-2 Black Knight bomber.
The other task you've got is ASIS, Ormack continued. Air Force is finally considering putting a pilot-trained navigator-bombardier on board the B-2. You've got a few months to get ASIS ready for full-scale production and retrofit. The B-2 pilot union is not too happy about this. They think ASIS is a bunch of bull, and the B-2 should keep its 2 pilots. I think our experience with the Old Dog proved otherwise.
Man, I can't wait, McClanahan exclaimed. What's ASIS stand for?
We say it stands for Attack Systems Integration Station. Pilots call it something else. They say ASIS stands for Additional Shit Inside.
The Black Knight stealth bomber was designed to attack heavily defended targets around the world. To fly 5,000 miles unrefueled, the B-2 had to be huge. In the past, Building a bomber of that size meant it was a sitting duck for enemy defenses. The Black Monster before Patrick McClanahan was the latest answer. The B-2 was a 250,000-pound bomber, but most of its surfaces were made of non-metallic composites that reduced reflected enemy radar energy. Its state-of-the-art systems were so advanced that the B-2 bomber could strike before it could be detected by enemy radars. The cost of the Black Knight bomber program was $500 million per plane. For a nation with a $200 billion deficit and a shrinking Soviet military threat, the B-2 bomber was sticker shock in its most intense form. A planned total purchase of 132 B-2 bombers went away, replaced with an extended procurement deal that would bring only 75 bombers online. By April of 1992, there were only 12 fully operational B-2 bombers in the inventory. "Got time for a walk around, sir?" McClanahan asked.
"You bet,"
the young Air Force general replied. The B-2 had no fuselage, as on more conventional airplanes. The plane's flying wing design had no vertical flight control surfaces that would create a radar reflector. Patrick ducked under the pointed nose. "Are these the laser and IR windows?" Patrick asked Ormac.
"You got it, Patrick,"
Ormac replied. "Where's the navigation radar? Is there one on the B-2?
"You bet. Multi-mode radar mounted along the wing leading edges. We could even add air-to-air capability to the system."
"Air-to-air on a B-2 bomber?" McClanahan exclaimed. "You're kidding, right?"
"Not after what we did on the B-52 old dog," Ormac replied. "Besides, it has no snotch of a hot jet any way you look at it. And at high altitude, it has the same roll rate and can pull as many G's as an F-4 Phantom."
"It'll make a great battleship escort," McClanahan said. "I think the boss is right. It's a waste to have these babies sitting on the sidelines with nukes on board while we're getting hammered in some non-nuclear dogfight." Ormac shrugged.
"I'm not convinced myself that the B-2 can make a good defensive escort plane. If a fighter gets a visual on this thing, you're dead."
"I don't know about that," Patrick said. "I think it'll be tough to kill in a tactical battle." Ormac didn't have a reply right away.
"You bring up a few good points, Patrick," Ormac admitted. "You know what this calls for?"
"The Strategic Warfare Center, General Jarrell's little playland up in South Dakota."
"Exactly," Ormac said. "We'll have to put an EB-2 up against a few fighters on Jarrell's range and see what happens."
"Throw me in that briar patch," McClanahan quipped as they moved forward to the new entry hatch. Patrick's new bird was AF-SAC-90-007, the seventh B-2 bomber built. The B-2 bomber's cockpit was massive. There was almost enough room for McClanahan to stand up straight as he slid into the right seat and began to strap in. "Where are all the instruments?" McClanahan exclaimed with obvious surprise. "There's hardly anything here. Did they give us a stripped-down test article or what?"
"This is a fully functional production model, Patrick," Ormac replied. "Everything is done in the MFDs. We're using the switches on the throttles and control stick. The screens show menu choices, and you just push a button to select it or use the set button on the stick."
"But I don't see any flight control system switches," McClanahan persisted. "What about a flap lever? Gear handles? How do you raise the landing gear?"
"This is almost the 21st century, Ormac replied. "We don't move levers. We tell the plane what to do, and it takes care of it."
"Computerized flying, huh?"
"It's advanced, but not foolproof," Ormac said. "The pilot is still important."
"This looks like a duplicate of the pilot's side," McClanahan observed.
"I think it is," Ormac said. "The original idea was to have two pilots, remember?"
As Ormac watched, Patrick suddenly reached down to a keyboard on the right bulkhead and pulled it out.
"Hey!"
"Sir, small MFDs are nice, but they're old technology. The nav has got to focus on one screen at a time to do his job. What happens then? He loses situational awareness. You make him less effective, not more."
"But these are the best MFDs available," Ormac said wryly.
"They're outdated," McClanahan repeated. "You want my recommendations, you'll get them," McClanahan said. "You didn't mention any restrictions, so I'll build the best cockpit I can think of." He paused for a moment, then said, "And we'll start with the Armstrong Aerospace Medical Research Laboratory at Wright Patt."
"The super cockpit? You want to put one of those big 6-square-foot screens in the B-2 bomber?"
"Sir, it's tailor-made for the Black Knight," McClanahan said excitedly. "We can have a demo flight within 6 months, I guarantee it." He paused for a moment, then added, "And after we get super cockpit installed, we can install that Skymaster's incorporated Pacer Sky system General Elliott is working on. Real-time satellite target reconnaissance. Damn, wouldn't that be awesome? Jeez, I can't wait to get started now."
"Jeez, Patrick,"
Ormac finally exclaimed with a smile.
You've already come up with 6 months' worth of work. You've probably busted the bank as well.
Ormac tried to ignore McClanahan's smug smile.
Well, you've got your work cut out for you. When can you get to work?
Right away, General, McClanahan replied. Right after we get back from lunch.
Your treat, I believe.
Over New Mexico. With his boyish face, his baseball cap, and his 32-ounce squeeze bottle of Pepsi-Cola, Jonathan Cullen Masters looked like a kid at a Saturday afternoon ball game. Luckily, the baseball cap hid Masters' hair, or his cowlicks would have made him appear even younger, to the range officers and technicians standing by. Masters, his assistants, and a handful of Air Force officials were on board a converted DC-10 airliner, 45,000 feet over the White Sands Missile Test Range in south-central New Mexico. Masters had his feet up on a raised track in the cargo section of the massive airliner.
The winds are kicking up again, Dr. Masters,
Air Force Colonel Ralph Foch said to Jonathan.
Alarm has acknowledged the change, Masters said. We got it covered, Ralph.
The object called Alarm, that Masters so lovingly regarded, was the Air Launch Alert Response Missile. Alarm was a four-stage space booster designed to place up to half-ton payloads in low to medium Earth orbit by launching the booster from the cargo hold on an aircraft. An alarm booster could carry as much as 1,500 pounds in its 10-feet-long, 40-inch diameter payload bay. On today's mission, each of Masters' alarm boosters carried four small satellites, which John Masters, in his own inimitable way, called NERTSATs, needed right this second satellites. NERTSATs were small, lightweight satellites which carried only a few communications channels. NERTSATs orbited the Earth once every 90 to 300 minutes, which meant that more than one satellite had to be launched to cover a particular area. But a NERTSAT cost less than 1/50th the price of a full-size satellite. Even with a constellation of four NERTSATs, a customer could get it for less than 1/10th the cost of placing a new satellite into orbit. Masters' customer this day was the Department of Defense, which is why all the military observers were on hand. Masters was to place four NERTSATs in orbit over the Western Pacific to provide the Navy and Air Force with specialized video communications between ships, aircraft, and land-based controllers. In 2 years of testing and over 24 launches, not one alarm booster had ever failed to do its thing, and not one NERTSAT had ever failed to function. It was quite a testimony to the genius of 31-year-old Jonathan Cullen Masters. The first love of his life was NASA, the National Aeronautical and Space Administration, and he went to work for the space agency immediately after leaving MIT. Almost every satellite and subsystem developed for the shuttle was at least partially designed by Jonathan Cullen Masters. In 1985, at age 24, he was offered a seat on the board of directors of Sky Sciences Incorporated. Masters resigned from NASA to become a vice president in charge of research for the small company. In 1988, John Masters, now chairman of the board and president of Sky Sciences, renamed Sky Masters Incorporated, announced that he had developed a low-cost space booster that was small and easy to operate. Alarm was born. Alarm used the launch aircraft as its first stage booster. Two alarm boosters could be standing by on board the carrier aircraft. It would only need to bring the payloads on board and take off. With aerial refueling, the alarm boosters could stay aloft for days. With several different payloads on board, the flexibility of the system was unparalleled.
15 minutes to launch window one, John,
Masters Launch Control Officer Helen Kadiri called out.
Thanks, Helen,
John replied.
Let's get Roosevelt in position and get ready.
Kadiri grimaced at another of Masters' quirks. He named his boosters, not just numbered them.
Crow, this is John. Roosevelt One is moving stage center. Stand by.
Roosevelt One in position,
Kadiri called out as she peered through the observation ports.
Flight deck, confirm lateral and longitudinal trim.
Aircraft trim nominal, the flight engineer reported. Standing by.
Roger. Confirm hatch closed and locked.
Foch was staring at one of the screens of the console.
I show the winds at maximum Q limits, Dr. Masters, he said. I recommend you abort.
Roosevelt says he's a go, Masters replied, checking the readouts again. I recommend we proceed.
John looked at Kadiri as he hit the intercom button.
Helen?
Well, she thought at least he consulted her on something. She said hesitantly,
it's pretty risky, John.
Unless I hear a definite no, guys, we're a go.
You are right on the borderline here, Dr. Masters, Foch finally said, but you're still within the safety margin.
You've got the con, Helen,
Masters told her excitedly.
Crew,
Stand by for launch sequence,
Padiri radioed.
Doors open. 30 seconds to go,
Masters said. Those 30 seconds seemed to take hours. Masters was about to call to Helen when she started counting.
Stand by for launch. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, release.
Rocket away, rocket away, Helen called out. Immediately, the DC-10 began a 30-degree bank turn to the left, and Roosevelt 1 was lost from the bomb bay camera.
We're clear from booster's flight path, Padiri called out. Come up on first stage ignition now.
The first stage motor of the alarm booster ignited, and the rocket leaped ahead of the DC-10 in a blur of motion.
T plus 30 seconds, passing 120K altitude, velocity passing Mach 3, Padiri reported.
Launch chamber doors closed, one of the techs reported. Ready to reload.
T plus 60 seconds, Kadiri reported. Altitude 180K, passing Mach 6, pitch angle 30 degrees. All systems nominal.
76 seconds after ignition, the first stage motor burned out, and the rear half separated from the rest of the booster. The rocket was nearly 250,000 feet above Earth. 9 seconds later, the second stage motor ignited, sending the booster streaking into space.
Good second stage ignition, Kadiri reported. Second stage nozzle reports a gimbal limit fault, John. It might have overcorrected for winds at altitude and sustained some damage.
Masters was counting down to the second stage burnout.
40 seconds to second stage burnout, he muttered. Is it still hitting a stop? Is it correcting its course? Continuous faults on the nozzle, Kadiri replied. It's maintaining course, but it might slip out of tolerance limits.
If it could not be placed in a position where it was not a hazard to other satellites, it would have to be destroyed. Masters sat back and put his feet up on the control console.
10 seconds to second stage burnout,
he said, sipping his soda.
It'll stay in the groove.
The decision doesn't rest with you this time, Masters, Foch said.
Ha! Masters suddenly shouted. Second stage burnout and Roosevelt 1 is still on course. I'd get your finger away from that destruct button if I was you, Colonel. The Navy wouldn't think kindly of having you blow up a perfectly good booster.
Clark Air Base, Republic of Philippines. One of the first uses of the new NERTSAT constellation for Air Force aircraft was several weeks later. It was the day the last of the United States Air Force's aircraft departed the Philippines as the American military bases were officially turned over to full Philippine control. The satellites were to be used to control the last of the American fighters and tankers as they withdrew from the Philippines to bases in Japan and Guam. Richard Ratstone was the commander of the now disbanded 13th Air Force, the principal American air defense organization in the Republic of the Philippines. General Stone, nicknamed Rat, short for Rat Killer because after strafing his F-4 along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Army units on the ground found dozens of rats killed by cannon fire, commanded the 20 different organizations from 5 major operating commands at Clark Air Base. Clark Air Base had been a vital link to the Pacific since it opened in 1903. Now it was all being handed to the Philippines. Stone's gaze moved from his country's flag to the protesters outside the perimeter fence a few blocks away. At least 10,000 persons were pressed against the barbed wire top fences, shouting anti-American slogans and tossing garbage over the brick wall. Armored personnel carriers were arranged along the wall, though being pelted so badly that the carrier's crews dared not poke their heads out or even open one of the thin eye portals. The 13th Air Force commander had aged far beyond his 50 years in the last few months. Stone was a soft-spoken fighter pilot who had risen through the ranks from an officer training school pilot candidate during the Vietnam War to a 2-star general and commander of a major military installation. In the past year, he had found himself supervising a degrading withdrawal from the base and country that he had learned to love. From a contingent of nearly 11,000 men and women 12 months earlier, 200 American military personnel were assembled in front of the reviewing stand to march one last time in parade. Part of the reason for the huge demonstration outside the perimeter fence was the presence of the two men on the reviewing stand with Stone, the Philippine President, Arturo Micaso, and the first Vice President, Daniel Tequina. Micaso was the elder statesman, a 70-year-old, a wealthy landowner, and ex-senator who was immensely popular with most Filipinos. Part of the coalition formed during the 1994 elections was the appointment of Daniel Tequina as first vice president and leader of the Philippine House of Representatives. Tequina was much younger than Micaso and leader of the National Democratic Front, a leftist political organization that had carried the cry for the Philippines to cut all ties with the West and to not renew the leases on American military bases.
The National Democratic Front flourished under the Picasso-Tikhina coalition government. A national referendum was called after the 1994 elections, which forbade the president to extend the leases for the American bases any further. The referendum passed by a narrow margin, and the United States was ordered to withdraw all military forces and turn control of the installations to the Philippine government within 6 months. President Picasso stepped forward to the podium. The crowd began to cheer, and applause issued from the bleachers. Picasso spoke in flawless English. "My friends and fellow Filipinos, on this day of freedom and independence, we mark a significant milestone in the future of the Philippines. For over 90 years, we have relied on the people of the United States for our security. Such an arrangement has greatly benefited our country and all its people. For this, we will be eternally grateful. The people of the Philippines now take their place among the democratic nations of this brave new world. I ask all my fellow Filipinos to join with me in forming a strong united nation of democratic ideals and a land of strong, true, lasting friends. May God bless the United States of America, and may God bless the Republic of the Philippines." The audience's applause for Picasso was genuine and appreciative. Tikhina got to his feet, stepped beside Picasso, and raised his hands over his head. A special set of three flagpoles had been erected behind the reviewing stand with the American and Philippine flags. An honor guard stepped onto the reviewing stand. As Picasso placed a hand over his heart in tribute, the Philippine flag was lowered a few feet in respect. As retreat was played, the American flag was raised at the top of the staff, then slowly lowered. When the flag was folded by the honor guard, it was passed to General Stone, who stepped to Arturo Picasso, saluted, and presented it to him.
"With thanks from a grateful nation, Mr. President," Stone said solemnly.
"It will be kept in a place of honor in the capital, General Stone," Picasso said.
"Thank you, sir."
At that, the two men looked skyward as a gentle roar of jet engines began to be heard. Flying over the base were four flights of four F-4 Phantom fighters, followed by a flight of three B-52 bombers. The audience applauded and cheered. Daniel Tikhina exploded.
"You see,"
he shouted, pointing at the planes overhead.
"The damned Americans are still threatening us."
He rushed to the microphone of the podium.
"My fellow Filipinos, this is an outrage. The Americans are threatening us with death from the skies."
Tikhina lowered the Philippine flag from its pole, unclipped it, and reattached it to the center pole from which the American flag had just been taken. He ordered one of his bodyguards to raise it. As it traveled up the pole, Stone heard one of the most chilling sounds he had ever experienced, screams of fury, anger, and jubilation coming from the protesters outside the gates. The American general helped Picasso rebalance himself.
"Mr. President, you must say something now," Stone said to him. "There could be a riot."
Tikhina turned to the president and snatched the American flag from his arms. Stone made a grab for it, but the bodyguard shoved him away, a hand menacingly inside his jacket. He had no choice but to stay back. The Philippine first vice president returned to the podium, raised the American flag overhead, held it so the TV cameras could get some good shots, and tossed it to the ground.
"Leave our country," he said. "Take your imperialist flags and your warplanes and leave our country."
Tikhina's bodyguards had drawn their machine pistols but kept them out of sight. Stone raised a hand towards the guard facing him, then went to the parade adjutant general, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Craig.
"Colonel, reform the parade, dismiss them, and then have them form two columns. Have them escort the audience out to the buses."
Picasso had gotten to his feet.
"What was the meaning of this, Tikhina?" he asked. "You have shamed our country in front of the entire world."
Tikhina held up his hands.
"This was not meant as a challenge to your authority, Arturo," he said. "I had thought our fellow Filipinos wanted to rejoice in the return of Mission Pampanga. I'm sorry I allowed my emotions to overtake me."
With the American troops off the mall and the first vice president heading for his private helicopter, the crowds outside the fence dispersed. President Picasso was led away by his bodyguards. Thus ended the American presence in the Philippines. Near the Spratly Islands, South China Sea. Admiral Yin Po Lun's Spratly Island flotilla was composed of 14 small combatants with young, inexperienced crews. On the outer perimeter, Yin deployed three Huangfen-class fast-attack missile boats and four Hegu-class fast-attack missile boats with anti-submarine and anti-aircraft weapons. He had an old Yin Yun-class minesweeper on the point. He also had two big Hainan-class fast patrol boats with anti-air, anti-ship, and anti-submarine weapons moving between the inner and outer perimeters. Yin's flagship was a beauty, a true ocean-going craft. He sailed in a Type EF-5 guided missile destroyer named the Hong Long, or Red Dragon. It had a propulsion system that propelled the 132-meter, 5,000-ton vessel to a top speed of over 35 nautical miles per hour. The Hong Long had a helicopter hangar and launch platform and carried a modern French-built Dauphin II helicopter. His destroyer also carried 6 supersonic Phalung 7 anti-ship missiles, 2 Phalung 9 supersonic anti-ship missiles, 2 anti-air missile launchers, a dual-purpose 100-millimeter gun, and 4 single-barreled and 2 double-barreled 37-millimeter anti-aircraft guns. It also had a single phalanx close-in weapon system gun. The Hong Long carried sonar and sophisticated targeting radars for her entire arsenal. The Spratly Islands seemed the most unlikely place in the world to send an important flotilla of the People's Liberation Navy. The Spratlys, called Nan Sha Dao in Chinese, were a collection of reefs, atolls, and semi-submerged islands in the middle of the South China Sea.
"See, I hit the bridge," the interphone crackled to life. "Wenshan reports surface contact, bearing 340, range 18 miles, station ready target."
Captain Lubu grunted a curt,
"Understood,"
in reply, then checked the radar plot. Lubu turned to Admiral Yin. "Sir, a surface contact is near Fuki Island, in the neutral zone about 20 miles north of Pearson Reef. We have Wenshan and Xingyi in position to investigate the contact."
"Send Wenshan and Xingyi to investigate,"
Yin ordered. Captain Lubu acknowledged the order. 30 minutes later, the task force had closed within 9 miles of the contact, while Wenshan and Xingyi had closed within 1 mile.
"Dragon, this is 7.
The skipper aboard Wenshan, Captain Han, radioed back to Admiral Yin. "I have visible contact. The target is an oil derrick. It appears to be mounted atop Fukui Island. It is surrounded by several supply barges, and 2 tugboats are nearby." Yin was clearly angered.
"An oil derrick in the neutral zone," he shouted. "How dare they place an oil derrick on Chinese island?"
He turned to Lubu.
"I want the transmissions relayed to us. Permission granted to hail the derrick. Tell Captain Hunt to warn the crew that they will be attacked if they do not remove that derrick from the neutral zone immediately."
A few moments later, Yin heard, "Attention, attention, the oil derrick on Fukui Island. This is the People's Republic of China frigate Wenshan. Respond immediately. Over."
"Frigate Wenshan, this is National Oil Company, Barge 19. We read you loud and clear. Over."
"National Oil Barge 19,
Han continued.
"You are violating international agreements. You are ordered to remove all equipment immediately and vacate the area. You will receive no further warnings. Comply immediately. Over."
"Vessel Wenshan, we are involved in search and salvage operations,"
a new voice replied.
"Salvage operations are permitted in international waters." "National Oil Barge 19, commercial operations in these waters are a direct threat to the national security and business interests of the People's Republic of China,"
Captain Han replied.
"Captain Lobo, relay to Captain Han on Wenshan. You are ordered to board within 1,000 meters of the platform. Then dispatch a boarding crew to take personnel on board the derrick into custody. After crew has been removed, you will destroy the entire facility with heavy gunfire. To Xingyi, have them ready to assist. To the rest of this task group, go to general quarters. Relay this message immediately and execute."
Lubu bowed to Admiral Yin and turned to relay the orders. Moments later, the general quarters whistle rang out throughout the decks of the destroyer Hong Long and the rest of Yin's task force group. Aboard the fast missile patrol craft Wenshan.
"All combat stations report ready, sir,"
the officer of the deck replied to Captain Han. The skipper of the Wenshan picked up the secure intership phone.
"Dragon, 7 reports combat stations, manned and ready. Number 1 launch is manned and ready, sir,"
the officer of the deck reported. A few minutes later, the motor launches were lowered overboard. Each wooden launch, 40 feet long and 8 feet wide, carried a crew of 3 and 8 sailors armed with rifles and sidearms. The launches were only a few dozen meters away from the Wenshan when the world seemed to explode for Admiral Yin, Captain Han, Captain Lubu, and the rest of the task force. At that moment, winks of light could be seen from the barges on Fuki Island. Seconds later, bullets began pelting the starboard side of the Wenshan as the crewmen aboard the oil derrick barges fired on the approaching launches and at the Wenshan itself. Captain Han dashed back onto the bridge.
"Hey, due to Hong Kong, we are under fire from oil barges."
At that instant, the Wenshan was pushed towards the island and struck a coral outcropping surrounding Fuki Island. The patrol boat heeled sharply. A sudden crunching stopped, flinging every crewman on the bridge off his feet. The officer of the deck raised his headset microphone and shouted,
"Come, bridge, way to Hong Kong. We are under fire. We have hit the reef."
But the message that was transmitted to the rest of the task force group by the terrified radio men was,
"Wenshan to Hong Long, we are under fire, we have been hit."
Aboard the flagship Hong Long, Admiral Yin was listening to Captain Han's progress when the warning from the Wenshan pierced the air. He leaped to his feet, then shouted,
"Order Wenshan and Wing Shi to open fire. Full missile and gun salvo."
Rubel wasn't going to question this order. He calmly relayed the command to his officer at the deck. As soon as the warning cry had been issued by Captain Han, Captain Milian on Xing Yi had ordered all missiles and guns made ready for action. 10 seconds later, he received the message from Admiral Yin, and 2 seconds later, the Fei Lung guided missiles were in the air. The pointed armor-piercing thruster cap of the Fei Lung missile allowed the missile to drive through the thin hull of the outermost barge before detonating the warhead. The high-explosive warhead created a tremendous fireball, but it was the partially expended solid rocket motor that created a mass firestorm all across the Philippine oil platform. A wall of fire washed across Phuky Island. As Wenshan eased away from the huge fires, Xing Yi launched 2 more missiles, until Admiral Yin ordered them to stop. Admiral Yin's intent was clear. He wanted no one alive on that platform.
"Seven, this is Vargon," the radio message began. "Hey, cover, your boarding parties, over."
Captain Han picked up the radio microphone.
"I copy, Vargon. I recommend one of my launchers search for survivors, over."
"Request denied, Seven," came the reply. "Vargon leader orders all units to withdraw."
1 hour later, all traces of the Philippine oil derrick and barges were swept away in the South China Sea currents. The oil platform had ceased to exist. U.S. Air Force Strategic Warfare Center, Ellsworth Air Force Base, South Dakota.
Room!
And hut!
200 men and women in flight suits moved to their feet as Air Force Brigadier General Calvin Jarrell and his staff entered the briefing room. It looked like the setting for countless other combat missions briefings from years past, except these men and women, all SAC warriors, weren't going to war. At least, not a real one. With an almost non-existent Warsaw Pact threat and severe military budget cuts, many believed that the Strategic Air Command was on the way out. Certainly, the critics thought, SAC's air crew members had nothing to look forward to for the next century. The 50 B-2 bombers and 100 rail garrison peacekeeper intercontinental ballistic missiles, planned to be operational by then, might be the only nuclear-armed weapons in SAC's inventory. All the rest of the aircraft were rumored to end up in the reserves or in the boneyard. It was a winding-down period for SAC, which created questions about readiness, training, and motivation. That's where Jarrell's Strategic Warfare Center School and the Air Battle Force came in. General Cal Jarrell was thinking of this as he entered the main briefing auditorium.
"Seats," he said, as he made his way to the stage.
"Fellow SAC crew members and invited guests, I am Brigadier General Calvin Jarrell. Welcome to Ellsworth Air Force Base, to the 99th Strategic Weapons Wing, the 1st Air Battle Wing, the Air Force Strategic Warfare Center, and to Task Force 94-10. My staff and I are here to assist you in becoming experts in the many facets of strategic warfare. We extend a special welcome to the 1st B-2 Black Knight Stealth Bomber Crews to attend the Strategic Warfare Center School. I look forward to watching you guys in action, and I wish you luck."
There was a ripple of applause for the B-2 bomber crews, and Patrick McClanahan joined in. This was where he belonged, he thought. He had been isolated at Dreamland for too long. Gerald continued.
"From this moment on, you are members of the 1st Air Battle Wing. You will learn to fly and fight as a team. Each of you will have knowledge of not only his or her own capabilities, but those of your colleagues. Since the Strategic Warfare Center opened back in 1989, the mission of this unit is to provide you with 8 weeks of concentrated training in strategic combat," Jarrell began. "The center consists of state-of-the-art systems, classrooms, and simulators, and, of course, the Strategic Training Range Complex, over 3,000 miles of low- and high-altitude military training routes spread out over 9 states. It also includes several support organizations. We also have the services of the 119th Fighter Interceptor Group with 10 Air National Guard F-16 ADF fighters and 5 brand-new F-23 fighters that act as aggressors for us."
Fighters were the SAC air crew's deadliest enemy. Watching a B-52 or B-1 bomber die was a frightening, mind-jarring experience.
"We accomplish our mission with a totally realistic training environment where we immerse you in a combat scenario and force you to respond to situations as they would occur in a real strategic conflict. In conclusion, ladies and gentlemen," Jarrell went on, "I want you to learn. Here is where you will combine your skills as SAC warriors with the skills you will need to face any challenge that a long, protracted conflict may present to you.
My staff and I will do everything we can to ensure that you come away from Ellsworth with a real sense of how a strategic battle might be fought. Thank you very much, and good luck.
2 weeks later. Our recent withdrawal from the Philippines has underscored the need to do more with less, Lieutenant Colonel Patrick McClanahan began. We have fewer bases, yet we have the same or even greater areas of responsibility and involvement in the world. The Navy has responded with expanding the role of the Surface Action Group. I'd like to discuss the application of Air Battle Force joint operations in conjunction with a Naval Surface Action Group. I think this can be the ABF's most valuable contribution. Each component makes the whole package that much stronger.
It wouldn't just have to do with weapons employment either,
said Major Henry Cobb, Patrick's aircraft commander.
Air Battle Force aircraft would also be useful in expanding the combat radius of the Surface Action Group by providing over-the-horizon surveillance.
General Gerald and his deputy commander of operations, Colonel Johnson Levitt, were the presiding officers in a professional topics roundtable. Gerald liked to play good guy, bad guy, where either he or Levitt would be the agreeable evaluator and the other would play the disapproving evaluator. This time, Gerald wanted to be the bad guy. He rolled his eyes in feigned exasperation and said,
"Excuse me, Colonel McClanahan, but you said you thought it was a good idea to have air battle force assets supporting naval operations."
"Absolutely, sir," Patrick replied. "Now, what kind of weapons are you talking about?" Colonel Levitt asked. "What would you arm your planes with?" As McClanahan opened his mouth to respond, Levitt added, "Major Cobb?" Henry Cobb looked a bit taken aback, but he replied,
"Well, obviously, anti-ship weapons like Harpoon, but we could use conventional bombs to hit the larger ships."
"You'd arm your B-2 bomber with gravity bombs?"
Gerald asked.
"You agree, Colonel McClanahan?"
"Standoff weapons or conventional cruise missiles would be my first choice," Patrick admitted, "but I'd also recognize that you might not always have your weapon of choice. Certainly plan a mission with gravity weapons, being careful to tell the task force commander what the chances would be of success."
"All right, we'll get you your Harpoon missiles. How many can a B-2 carry again?"
Gerald asked. 12, McClanahan replied. 6 on a rotary launcher, 1 launcher in each bomb bay. "All right," Levitt said. "We've got 4 bombs here. Not very many, but it represents 1/3 of the current fleet. Joint task force commander wants you to bomb a Soviet cruiser. No Harpoon, no missiles, but gravity bombs. Now, what do you tell him, Major Cobb?"
"I tell him that he could expect some dead B-2 bombers unless we were given standoff weapons or cruise missiles,"
Cobb replied.
"Tough bananas, Major," Gerald pressed. "I want the cruiser attacked and destroyed. You get gravity weapons only. You've been given the order to do it. Now, what next?"
Cobb rolled his eyes in exasperation, but replied,
"Then I hope for a typhoon I can hide behind. I go in at night from multiple axes of attack. I don't have to load up on too many bombs so I can carry more gas and fly faster into the target. I try to create diversions, anything and everything I could."
Both Gerald and Levitt looked grim. "You got one other option," Levitt said. "What is it, Colonel McClanahan?" Patrick shook his head. "Sorry, sir, but I can't see any other option."
"I didn't think so," Gerald said. "The one option any Air Force commander has, recommend no action. There's no mission that's so important that you have to throw valuable lives and resources away to try to accomplish. You need to be smarter than this. You two are dismissed."
Cobb and McClanahan got to their feet, stood at attention, and turned and departed. He turned to Levitt.
"So how would you rate these guys?"
"They know their shit, that's for sure. I definitely want them flying my missions. But as far as planning my missions, I rank them middle of the pack. I think we've opened their eyes today, but what they do with that knowledge remains to be seen." New Phuket Islands. The number 2 task force of Admiral Yin Po Lun's Spratly Island flotilla was again cruising within radar range of Phuket Island. Unlike the more powerful 10-ship task force that surrounded Admiral Yin's flagship, this one had only 4 ships, 2 Hainan-class patrol boats, a Yin Yun-class minesweeper, and a Hong Fen-class fast-attack missile aircraft, the Chagda, which acted as the command vessel for this faster, shallow-draft patrol group. Commander Chow T.U., skipper of the Chagda, felt uneasy with his latest orders. It had been 3 weeks since the attack on the Philippine oil barge, and the tension in the region was thick enough to cut with a knife. Chow would never say so to anyone, but Yin's actions could be characterized as unprofessional.
Chow felt that the Admiral had every right to confront the illegally placed oil rig, and he was well within his responsibilities when he returned fire. But to simply skulk away from the area without offering any help was very suspicious. A task force as powerful as Yin's could afford to be generous in its rescue operations. "Surface contact, sir," an officer in the bridge crew suddenly blurted out. "Bearing 050 degrees, range 20 kilometers, speed 0. Chow turned to the plotting board as another crewman penciled in the contact. "Confirm the contact," Chow ordered. "Make sure you're not painting the island itself."
"Radar confirms contact as a vessel,"
the combat officer replied. "Send a flash emergency message to Dragon," he finally ordered his officer of the deck. "Inform him of our radar contact. We will stand by for instructions." They did not have long to wait.
"Message from Dragon, sir,"
the officer of the deck reported. "Task Force 2 is hereby ordered to cross into the Nansha Island neutral zone immediately. Investigate contact on Fuki Island. Identify all intruders. Detain all persons. This time, rules of engagement. Do not fire unless fired upon, but repel assaults with all available resources. Helicopter will be dispatched immediately to assist. Dragon Task Force en route to your location. ETA 2.3 hours. Message ends."
"All ships are at general quarters,"
the officer on deck continued. Chow was just donning his life jacket and baseball cap in lieu of a combat helmet.
"All ship weapons, manned and ready." "Very well. I want range to Fuki Island every kilometer,"
Chow ordered.
"Sir, acquisition radar detected, bearing 050.
A report came from combat.
19 kilometers to Fuki Island and closing,
came the range report from the navigation officer.
"Speed 10 knots. Negros Oriental class,"
the officer on the deck announced.
"Latest intelligence reports that the Nueva Vizcaya putting out to sea. It may have arrived here in this practice,"
Chow nodded. Nueva Vizcaya was one of two active ex-U.S. anti-submarine warfare vessels operated by the Philippine Navy. Its heaviest weapon was a 76-millimeter cannon, as well as 40 and 20-millimeter anti-aircraft and anti-missile guns that might be a danger to the Hong Lung's helicopter as far as 6 kilometers away.
"Message from Bao Ji, sir," the radio technician screamed out. "Radar contact aircraft bearing 190, 15 kilometers. Radar showing 3 aircraft altitude less than 10 meters, speed 60 knots. Suspect rotary wing aircraft. Range now 13.5 kilometers and closing."
"All ships defensive maneuvering,"
Commander Chow ordered.
"Active ACM and decoys. Signal Dragon, report possible air attack from southeast."
"Missile in the air,"
someone screamed. Directly ahead, a bright flash of light could be seen. Another flash of light followed. The trail of the missile straight this time, headed right for Chadnar.
"Hold starboard,"
Chow shouted.
"Flank speed. Chaff rockets. Release batteries on all guns. All guns anti-missile barrage."
The portside 30-millimeter anti-aircraft guns began pounding into the sky, guided by the round ball fire control radar. At the same time, small rockets fired off the fantail into the night sky. This was the ERC-1 decoy system. Every member of the bridge crew was staring out towards Fuki Island when suddenly a terrific burst of light split the air, and the low profile of the minesweeper Guangzhou was highlighted in a huge ball of fire. Several secondary eruptions quickly followed. Commander Chow had never seen such a horrifying sight.
"Guangzhou, the minesweeper has been hit."
"Sir, Bao Ji reports. The helicopters are launching missiles."
The fast attack boat Bao Ji lost its battle seconds later. The Filipino helicopters carried 2 Sea Ray missiles each. One helicopter was paired with one patrol boat, and they drop-launched their missiles within 4 miles of their targets. The patrol boat Yan destroyed its helicopter with a burst of 40-millimeter gunfire. But the helicopter tracking Bao Ji managed to swerve long enough to keep the laser beam on target. Both Sea Ray missiles guided directly on the forecastle of the Bao Ji plowed into the bridge and combat control center, killing the captain, 12 senior bridge crewmen, and decimating its fighting capability. End of Side 1.
"Come to heading 300, flank speed,"
Chow ordered.
"Designate radar return on Fuki Island as target. Launch a 2-missile C-801 salvo."
Chow made a slight turn to the right, and seconds later, 2 C-801 missiles leaped into the sky. As Chow and his bridge crew stared out the forward windscreens, they saw a tremendous barrage of gunfire erupt from out near the horizon. The gunfire lasted only a few seconds, punctuated by a brilliant flash of light. One of Chagda's C-801 missiles was hit by a furious barrage of gunfire that could not have come from a relatively small craft, such as a Negros Oriental-class patrol vessel. The other C-801 missile never turned in the direction of the gunfire and had probably self-destructed.
"What was that?"
Chow shouted to his combat bridge crew. And it was then that Commander Chow realized what it was, the largest, most powerful vessel in the Philippine inventory, the PF-class destroyer escort frigate. The ex-U.S. Navy frigate had no fewer than 20 large-caliber radar-guided guns on board, along with two 76mm guns and a four-shot MK-141 Harpoon anti-ship missile launcher.
"Missile launch detected!" the combat officer cried out. "Harpoon missile in the air!"
The missile slammed into the Chinese patrol craft, piercing the main superstructure and driving down several decks before its warhead detonated. A second missile followed 5 seconds later, exploding in the engine room, creating a blossom of fire so huge that it created shadows on the water for 5 miles in all directions. Aboard the Spratly Island flotilla flagship Hong Long.
"Lost contact with Chow Tao, sir,"
the Combat Information Center officer reported to Admiral Yin.
"Last report was of a PF-class frigate near Fuki Island. No other details."
"Message from patrol craft Yan," the CIC officer reported. "Charter in sight and on fire. Reports from crewmen say they were hit by sea-skimming missiles. Patrol craft Baoji heavily damaged but underway. No contact with minesweeper Guangzhou. Yan requests permission to assist Charter."
"Permission granted,"
Admiral Yin replied. Incredible, simply incredible. The entire battle took all of 5 minutes. He clicked open the microphone.
"Captain Lobo, open a satellite channel to Dong Dao Airfield immediately. I want a Shui Hong 5 patrol craft fully armed for surface combat to rendezvous on this flagship immediately, and another standing by to relieve the first."
The Shui Hong 5 was a large turboprop flying boat used primarily for maritime patrol, but the 10 aircraft assigned full-time to his Nansha Island flotilla were fitted for anti-ship duties. The Shui Hong 5 was a significant threat to any ship that did not possess anti-aircraft missiles. And to Yin's knowledge, no Filipino warship carried anti-aircraft missiles, except perhaps short-range Stinger shoulder-fired weapons. Near Vandenberg, California. It was a spectacular day for flying. The skies were clear, the winds were calm and turbulence-free, which was rather unusual at 40,000 feet. Things were not quite as calm inside the special DC-10 aircraft orbiting off the California coast. There was only one massive shape in the cargo section of the DC-10 boost aircraft that morning, but John Masters was more concerned and agitated than ever. The shape was Skymasters Incorporated's newest air-launched space booster, nicknamed Jackson 1. It appeared the booster wasn't going anywhere.
"Damn it, what's the status up there?"
Masters asked on interphone from the launch control console. "We're still tracking down the interruption, John," Helen Kadiri replied.
"You've only got 5 more minutes,"
Masters reminded her.
"The last self-test report still shows a fault in the bird, John. I don't think you have any choice. You have to abort. Air Force is recommending an abort as well."
"Homer 7 was working just fine minutes ago,"
Masters shot back.
"I don't understand this."
Homer 7 was one of a constellation of 8 TDRS, or tracking and data relay satellites.
"Tell the Air Force to track down the fault in their satellite."
Masters threw off his headset and got up out of his seat. The senior launch control technician, Albert Red Phillips, immediately asked, "John, what about the countdown?"
"Continue the countdown, Red," John replied hotly. "No hold. I'll be back in 1 minute."
He then hurried forward to the flight deck. Masters checked the status screen for the launch aircraft's communication system. Everything was still reporting normal.
"I asked you to run a self-test of our system, Helen."
"And I told you, John, everything on our end checks out," Kadiri said.
"Helen, just run the self-test one more time, will you?"
She gave John another scowl as he excitedly leaned over her left shoulder to watch the test process on the screen.
"There," Master shouted. "Umbilical fiber optic hardwire continuity. Why did you bypass that test?"
"Come on, John, get real,"
Kadiri protested.
"That's not an electronics check. That's a visual check. Besides, the missile's been pulled out of the launch airlock."
"For Pete's sake, Helen,"
Master dashed back into the cargo section.
"Push it back in and check the umbilical connections,"
Master said.
"But we need the safe connectivity readout," Phillips said. "I'm still showing no tracking data from..."
"Bypass the safety locks, Red,"
Master said excitedly.
"Get the booster into position to launch."
The bypass showed up immediately on Helen Kadiri's alternate launch control board.
"John, I've got an unsafe warning light on. I show the interlocks off."
"I turned them off, Helen,"
John said on interphone.
"We're checking the umbilical plug."
"You can't do that, John,"
Helen warned in a stern voice. But just then the booster slid into position.
"Try the umbilical self-test,"
Master said to the launch bay technician. A moment later, Phillips gave him his answer.
"That's it, John,"
he said with a shout.
"There's a break in the umbilical connector."
Master scrambled inside the launch airlock and began crawling down along the alarm booster.
"This is Kadiri," I'm setting the interlock operator-initiated countdown hold. Crewmen of the launch airlock, interlocks on.
Gotta know when it restored. You got it, John. You got it, Phillips said. But we've passed the launch window.
Start the countdown at T-minus 60,
Master said. Less than 60 seconds later, the booster was on its way.
Good separation, good first-stage ignition, Helen reported as the missile accelerated ahead of the DC-10 and roared skyward.
Masters waited a few more moments, then said with a faint smile,
The plug was off by a fraction of an inch.
Good thing I caught it, huh?
It was an incredibly stupid thing you did, John,
the theory finally said.
You're unsafe. You think nothing of risking lives just as long as your precious boosters make it off.
You're being overdramatic, Masters said. Monitor your panel until the Air Force reports.
Monitor your own panel, Masters,
Helen said, rising up from her seat.
I'm tired of putting up with your antics. I'm a scientist and an engineer. I deserve respect. Just because you're some kind of boy genius doesn't mean the rest of the world has to be in awe of you.
Kadiri turned and stormed out of the cockpit. Masters was going to try to talk to her, but he could hear radio calls being made by the Air Force mission controllers, and he had no choice but to sit down and work the panel. Palawan Passage, the Philippines. The Hong Long Task Force had driven to within 20 kilometers of the fleeing Filipino fleet when the first Shui Hong 5 anti-ship flying boat arrived on the scene.
Talon 8-1, this is Bartle.
Admiral Yin Po on radio to the pilot of the flying boat.
Reconnoiter the Filipino attack fleet to the east. Report any hostile activity. Authorized to return fire.
Several minutes later, the pilot of the Shui Hong 5 aircraft reported,
Sir, Talon 8-1 reporting. We are in contact with four surface vessels. The larger vessels identified as PF-class frigates. Two smaller vessels, probably PSONF-class patrol vessels. Over.
Close to 5 kilometers. Maintain contact. Report any change in hostile status.
In order the patrol plane. The Shui Hong 5 pilot hesitated for a few long moments. Obviously, he just realized that his commanding officer had just ordered him to fly within gun range of the Filipino vessels. But the pilot responded hesitantly,
Yes, sir. Talon 8-1 copies.
The plane drove only a few kilometers closer before Admiral Yin heard the terrified voice of the pilot screaming in the radio that he was under fire from heavy anti-aircraft artillery.
Return fire, Admiral Yin ordered. Clear to launch air-to-surface missiles,
Yin turned to Captain Noble.
Are we receiving target telemetry from the patrol plane?
Yes, sir,
Noble responded.
Very well,
Yin said happily.
You may begin. Launch two Fei Lung missiles from long range. Get a spike report from the plane and re-attack with two more. I want this battle concluded as quickly as possible, Lubu.
30 minutes later.
Talon 8-1 reports one vessel afire, the PS-class patrol craft. One vessel believed to be an LF-class fire support landing craft has moved alongside to assist.
Admiral Yin cursed everyone he could think of, especially the manufacturers of the Fei Lung long-range anti-ship missile. The Shui Hong 5 attack plane had fired both its missiles and had hit the patrol boat with one. But four Fei Lung 7 missiles launched from Hong Lung had either missed or been destroyed. The Hong Lung had only two Fei Lung 7 missiles remaining. Of course, the Hong Lung also carried two more long-range missiles, the Fei Lung 9 supersonic missiles. And they had nuclear warheads. Each Fei Lung 9 missile carried a single 20-kiloton yield RK-55 thermonuclear warhead. Admiral Yin had never considered the use of these missiles. The nuclear warhead could be removed, and a conventional 513-kilogram-shaped charge warhead installed. The Fei Lung 9 was a superior weapon and was much more difficult to shoot down. But Yin did not order the RK-55 warheads removed from the Fei Lung 9 missiles. He still had two Fei Lung 7 missiles, and it was somewhat dangerous for the crew to download a missile from its launch canister and change warheads at night during a combat situation.
Status of Talon 8-1,
Yin ordered.
Combat ready, sir, Captain Luber replied. Armed with 6 torpedoes. Data link still active in all modes.
Order Talon 8-1 to attack with torpedoes,
Yin told Captain Lubu.
Specifically target the northern frigate. I want targeting information for the southern frigate and a second Fei Lung 7 salvo launched against it immediately. I do not want these cowardly trespassers to escape, Lubu. You understand me? Now carry out my orders, Captain.
High-speed fighter aircraft approaching Wenshan, sir,
Captain Lubu reported.
Emergency message from Wenshan. They've run aground.
What?
Yin shouted.
Wenshan is taking water,
the radio operator reported.
They are requesting assistance. Casualties reported.
Range to that fighter.
Range to Wenshan, 8 kilometers,
the combat technician reported.
Fighter still headed inbound.
Sir, radar reports the second frigate to the east,
Captain Luber reported.
Range 32 kilometers. Radar reports another contact off to the south. Range 37 kilometers, approaching at 15 knots. Also numerous air targets. They appear to be helicopters, sir. Three helicopters approaching.
Missile launch detection, combat reported.
Frigate to the east, launching missiles, sir. Choco reports missiles back on the waterline, sir.
Another report came.
No damage report. Lost contact with Choco.
Lost data link with Jing Yi, sir.
LF blast fire support vessel unsuspected torpedo on, sir.
Lubu shouted.
Later contact aircraft. Range 52 kilometers heading west at high speed.
Another report came.
Fighter aircraft from Puerto Princesa. ETA 5 minutes.
Sir, Captain Lubu said, stopping and standing as close to Yin as he dared,
we are running out of maneuvering room. One patrol boat is grounded, and the other ships are scattering and disoriented. Recommend we provide support coverage for our escorts. Once we are reorganized, we can steam out of the passage.
Yin unbuttoned the top button of his tunic, reached inside, and withdrew a large silver key. Lubu's mouth dropped open in surprise, and his eyes grew wide as he realized what it was.
Sir, Admiral, you cannot.
We cannot be raised like this, Captain, Yin said.
He inserted the key into a lock on the flat panel on the instrument console in front of his seat. Waited as the door popped open. Inside the compartment was a red-colored telephone handset with communications cords and several unmarked buttons. Admiral Yin picked up the red-handled phone.
This is Admiral Yin, he spoke. Command is Battle Cry. Battle Cry, over.
Admiral, you must stop this.
Lobo persisted.
2 minutes to lead bone execution,
the loudspeaker blared.
All decks reports ready.
My fleet is surrounded. We are under attack. We are in danger of losing most of the South China Sea to the Filipinos, Yin said.
But this will create a disaster of international proportions, Lubu argued.
Put on your protective gear and prepare for Red Moon execution, Captain,
Yin said through his mask and respirator.
That is an order.
You can't do this. We will be in a state of war with the entire world. Cancel the order, Admiral,
Lubu warned him.
Don your protective gear and stand by, Captain,
Yin said. Lobo's eyes telegraphed his next move. He lunged forward for the silver key in the lock of the control panel. Just as Lobo touched the key, a shot rang out. Lobo was thrown away from Yin's chair and onto the floor, a dark red stain spreading across his belly.
You are a coward and a dishonorable man, Lobo Lin Lee,
Yin said half aloud, placing the smoking pistol on the instrument console in front of him. Yin then picked up the red phone, lifted his mask and helmet and spoke.
Combat, this is Admiral Yin.
Combat, entering Red Moon countdown hold.
Execution order is Dragon Sword. Dragon Sword, seal the breach.
Just then Yin heard the collision warning horn sound on the bridge loudspeaker and the loud buzz of the phalanx close-in weapon system. The radar-guided Gatling gun automatically tracked inbound targets and opened fire with a murderous hail of 30-millimeter bullets when it computed the object within range. Yin heard another warning horn blare just as the huge explosion erupted outside the port windows. The incoming Harpoon missile had been hit by the phalanx cannon and detonated just as it began its terminal pop-up maneuver. He felt a huge overpressure in his ears moments before the big, thick observation windows bowed inwards and exploded like a balloon. Aboard Bear 01, Colonel Rinaldo Tamalco saw the patrol boat at about 3 miles from his F-4 Phantom and opened fire. He walked his 20-millimeter shells up to the ship's stern, and then, banking hard left, managed to stitch a line of bullets right down the center line.
Radar contact on another vessel, now 1 o'clock, 3 miles,
Vilas's weapons officer called out.
Roger,
Tamalco replied. He let his finger up off the trigger, and he began a series of wild vertical and horizontal movements. Snap! For a split second, Tamalco's eyes registered an impossibly bright flash of light on the horizon. And just as quickly as that, he was blind. His eyes were replaced by 2 red-hot spheres of excruciating pain. Vilas was screaming in the back seat.
Prepare for ejection! Eject! Eject!
Tamalco screamed, then crossed his wrists in front of him, grasped the ejection ring between his legs, and pulled. Tamalco's body was flying forward, the wall of superheated air rushing towards him from the explosion of the nuclear warhead of the Phalanx 9 missile was traveling at 2,000 feet per second. Tamalco, Vilas, and the crippled fighter were crushed into powder, then vaporized by the 5,000-degree heat of the fireball that had already destroyed the Philippine corvette Quezon and its 3 anti-ship helicopters. Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Base, Colorado, that same moment. In an effort to increase the number of nuclear detection devices in orbit in the late 1970s, a secret program code named Forest Green was implemented. Forest Green had global coverage because the 18-satellite Navstar constellation had at least three satellites looking at every piece of the Earth at every moment. The Forest Green program was largely unused because it had a disturbing propensity for reporting false explosions. A young female Air Force sergeant, Amy Hector, was on the Forest Green console when her detection board went crazy. Hector immediately swung her electret microphone closer to her lips, noticing, to her complete surprise, that her fingers were trembling. Red collar, she spoke. The words red collar would ensure immediate attention by all. Forest Green shows three units with amplitude pulse, threshold readings. The problem with the Forest Green sensors was that they were not highly directional. The explosion could have occurred anywhere from Hawaii to Thailand and from Japan to Australia. I need better information than that, Colonel Randolph, the senior duty controller, said.
Sir,
Hector interjected, I think I can come up with a rough triangulation.
Just do it, Amy. First, I need an acknowledgement of a suspected Forest Green event from Sync Space Com right away. Then we better get SAC and JCS on the line directly.
Yes, sir.
NORAD hasn't issued an alert yet, Randolph muttered half aloud. Why the hell haven't they said anything?
Aboard Skymasters Incorporated's DC-10 over California, at that same moment. John Masters had his feet up on the bulkhead, and the emotionless voice on the radio said, Masters 1, College, contact lost with Jackson 1.
College, this is Masters 1, I show.
The young scientist and engineer stopped abruptly. Confirmed on this end. Stand by. I'll try to reestablish communications. Masters checked the computer readouts of the last few seconds before losing contact with the satellite. It was dead on course, dead on altitude. Helen Kadiri entered the flight deck and stood over his shoulder scanning the readouts.
Problem, John?
She said in a sarcastic tone.
Look, we still have spacecraft power. The system has got to be in full reset. We've still got a few minutes until it needs to download its information. We still have time,
John said. The phone call from the Air Force came a few minutes later.
John, Space Command on the line. They're requesting we recover at Falcon Air Force Base ASAP. General Kane will meet us.
Kane was in charge of all Defense Department satellites from launch to recovery. He had an abiding distrust for civilian contractors doing military functions, and Masters was very high on his shit list.
We're in the middle of a mission, Masters retorted. Tell him we still have a satellite to recover.
There was a slight pause, then.
Pick up the line, John.
Masters here.
What the hell happened up there, Masters?
General Kane exploded.
We're still monitoring the NERTSAT, General. Give me a few more minutes and I'll reestablish contact. If I can't, I'll supervise the deorbit and recovery and we'll begin an investigation.
You won't touch that bird until I say you can, Masters.
Kane shouted over the radio phone line.
We'll supervise the deorbit and recover the satellite ourselves. Have your people stay clear of the booster until I can get a ship out there to recover it.
The booster doesn't belong to you, General, Masters said. I'll be happy to turn it over to you after I complete my investigation.
It belongs to me now, Buster,
Kane interrupted.
Air Force paid for it. You launched it into my territory. If we detect one lousy watt of energy being transmitted from you to that satellite, I'll put the cuffs on you myself. It's out of your hands, Masters. Land at Falcon Airfield immediately. Over and out.
Masters could feel the beginnings of a monster headache. To Helen Kadiri, he said wearily,
Start collecting up all the mission data information on hard copy. I'll monitor Spacecom to see they don't wreck my satellite when they deorbit it.
I've already started downloading the data, Kadiri said with a haughty smile, including transcribing the voice and launch data recorders. I'm sure Spacecom will want to examine all that as well.
Thanks, Dr. Kadiri, Master said. Thanks a heap.
Powder River MOA near Bell Creek, Montana.
You got the aircraft,
General Bradley Elliott said to Brigadier General Cal Gerald. Elliot felt a slight shake of the F-16D as Gerald took control.
I've got the aircraft, Gerald responded. Nice takeoff, General. You left those two wildcats eating fumes back there.
Call me Brad, Cal, Elliot said, unclipping his oxygen mask. Yep, I love these fighting Falcons. These F-23s are awesome, but I'll still take an F-16 into combat any day. Whisper 1-7, this is Alpha. I'll copy.
Loud and clear, Alpha.
A voice replied immediately. On interplane frequency, Elliot asked,
Having fun, Whisper?
Walk in the park so far, sir,
the voice of Patrick Monahan replied. Four targets struck, no opposition.
The satellite downlink is active, and we're awaiting a final transmission.
Gotta get to work. Over and out.
Satellites? Gerald exclaimed with surprise. You mean that bomber is getting target information from a satellite right now?
You got it, Cal, Elliot replied. We have a Sky Master's NERTSAT in orbit right now, ready to fly over Powder River.
We'll see, Gerald said skeptically. Your guys have got to get past AWACS and those.
And it was obvious what he was referring to. Two sleek F-23 Wildcat fighters that were beginning to hunt in earnest. We might have covered that as well.
Radar flight, this is Topper, the senior controller aboard the airborne warning and control aircraft radioed. Be advised, Topper has been successfully attacked and destroyed. Topper out.
I wasn't briefed on this, Gerald said. Who authorized this?
I did, Cal, Elliot explained. This is an important test for two of my projects, and I thought it was best.
You're the general, General, Gerald said.
There was a very slight pause then.
Carl, I want to see what you've got that can shoot down an AWACS and take on a couple of F-23 Wildcats. Tell your boys to press on.
The chase was exhilarating for Elliot to watch.
I'll be damned, Gerald said. That B-2 is marching through America's best air defense systems like they didn't exist.
Aboard Whisper 1-7.
I can't believe you talked to the fighters, sir,
Major Henry Cobb, the B-2 Bombers aircraft commander, said.
You know, the AWACS plane will pick up our transmission.
Relax, Henry, McClanahan said. Guardian took care of the AWACS plane. He's out of the war.
Amazing, Ormac said. Friggin' amazing. The NERTSAT system does away with year-old intelligence data, even charts. You have everything you need right here.
And I received it only 30 minutes ago, McClanahan added. Watch this. With the NERTSAT data, I've already seen what the bomb run and missile launch will look like. McClanahan changed the screen again to show a photograph quality view. He changed screens again. Here's the computer's predictions for the target area radar release offsets based on the NERTSAT data. And there they are, McClanahan announced. Fighters at 2 o'clock, two F-23 fighters. They're 20 miles out and above us. I don't think they got a radar lock on us yet, Henry.
Got jammers set up?
Not yet, McClanahan said. If we buzz them too early, they can get a bearing on us.
If you buzz them too late, they'll get a visual on us.
Maybe, maybe not, McClanahan said. In any case, they're too late. Sending range clearance request in now, he said. The reply came 30 seconds later. Range clearance received. All targets clear, McClanahan reported. He enlarged the weapon screen so Cobb could check it as well. The B-2 bomber carried one AGM-142A Popeye missile in the left bomb bay and a simulated second Popeye missile not intended to be released. The right bomb bay carried two AGM-130 Stryker rocket-powered glide bombs. Stryker worked in conjunction with HAVNAP to destroy area defenses and strike hardened targets with one bomber. It was a lethal combination. McClanahan spoke.
Left bay Popeye missile selected, he told Cobb.
Checks. Left bay weapon unlocked. All others locked.
The super multifunction display shimmered and abruptly changed. But something was very wrong. The image showed a confusing pattern of light spots in a blank, featureless background. It did have one prominent feature, a mountain nearly 20,000 feet high and 60 miles wide. What the hell? There's some glitch in the system. I'll reset the system and go manually, McClanahan said. I'll launch on pre-programmed target coordinates. Missile one ready. Pull up and over. Now. Cobb pulled back on the side stick controller, beginning a 2G climb. At the very same time, McClanahan selected the launch item from the weapons screen. The left bomb bay doors of the B-2 bomber slid open, and the AGM-142 missile was flung into the sky. The Popeye missile was an Israeli-built standoff missile, armed with a 700-pound high-explosive warhead. Its rocket motor fired, sending the missile out ahead of the B-2 and then skyward. Missile away, McClanahan called out. Cobb watched his moving map display. The instant the Popeye missile was launched, the fighters immediately turned and were headed right for them.
Fighters on our tail, 30 miles and closing, he said. Here's where it starts getting good.
The Popeye missile's long white smoke trail was pointing directly at the bomber. And Captain Ed Milo on the first F-23 Wildcat immediately saw it.
I got a smoke trail, he shouted. We got a bomber down low.
Band at 12 o'clock low, Colonel Joseph Mirisch, his flight commander of the second F-23, reported. Cobb's MFD reported a threat signal.
Fighters locked on,
he shouted. McClanahan quickly activated the track breakers. Jammers on. First GBU target in 20 seconds. 40 seconds remaining on Popeye.
Jesus, this is too close,
Ormac exclaimed. Motor burnout on the Popeye, McClanahan reported. It's going ballistic. 20 seconds to impact. 10 seconds to GBU release. Bomb away, McClanahan shouted.
Looking for a mobile missile erector launcher on the left screen. Nothing yet.
General Ormac was glued to the left side of the SMFD. He was so excited when he spotted the target that he couldn't help shouting, "Got it!"
"Thanks, boss," McClanahan said with a grin. "Target lock. Got it nailed. Switching to half nap. 21 seconds remaining."
"Hot damn!" Ormac cried out. "You buried that sucker. Damn, what a shot!"
But McClanahan wasn't listening. His eyes were now glued to the half-nap TV monitor. He seemed more agitated. Suddenly, he shouted, "Shit, they put up decoys!" Just then, he noticed an almost imperceptible movement of the high-resolution screen. "There it is! I got it!" He was far too late. The Popeye missile impacted short of the vertical tube. "Pretty sneaky putting decoys in the target area," McClanahan muttered. "I hope collateral damage got the right one, but I doubt it."
"What happened with the updated satellite data?"
Ormac asked. "I don't know," McConaughey replied. "Maybe there was a glitch in the satellite." Patrick bent towards the screen and began identifying more radar aim points. The F-23 fighters were 10 miles or 15 miles or 3 miles from the bandit. They couldn't tell which. They were chasing a ghost ship that just launched two missiles. 30 miles to go, lead," Milo radioed to Mirisch. "Copy," Mirisch replied. This was getting serious. There was an attacker out there, but he barely registered on any of their sensors. Milo's sharp eyes finally saw a very unnatural-looking shadow racing across the ground. Following the sun, Milo searched the sky and... "Tanaho!" he shouted.
"Jesus, lead, I got a B-2 bomber. 1 o'clock low is a fucking B-2 bomber."
"Take the lead, too," Mirisch shouted. "Leave me in and don't lose the bastard." Milo banked right and Mirisch followed, searching the ground for any sign of it. "There. Tanaho, radar 2-0. Mirisch was expecting a black shape, but this one was painted tan and green camouflage, blending perfectly with the terrain. It was flying very, very low, but the late afternoon shadows were long, and it was a dead giveaway. Suddenly, there was the worst squealing and chirping on the UHF radio frequency that Mirisch had ever heard. The jamming was no big deal. They had a visual on the bomber, and no B-2 was going to outrun an F-23. This guy is toast. He would deal with the B-2, then go back and take care of the newcomer with a big jammer. Cobb had the 300,000-pound bomber right at 300 feet above the ground and occasionally nudged it even lower. He knew the wild S-turns ate up speed, but one advantage of the water-based custom camouflage job on the B-2 was that it degraded the one attack option that no B-2 bomber could defend against, a visual gun attack. Plus, they had one more ace in the hole. "Guardian must be close to be blotting out the radios like this," McConaughey told Cobb and Ormac, "but I have no way of knowing where he is."
"I've got an idea, Patrick," Cobb said. "I'll try to deliver these guys right to Guardian's lap."
"Fox 3, radar 2-0, guns firing," Mirisch cried out on the primary radio. Suddenly, the B-2 bomber pulled up sharply. Mirisch's closure rate was a little fast, so he swung out to the bomber's left side to gain a bit more spacing. "Lead," he heard on the radio. "Pull up!" Mirisch swung his head forward. Devil's Tower, the huge rock spire, was not more than 2 miles ahead. If Milo hadn't yelled, he would have been dead in less than 12 seconds.
"I got it," Mirisch called back. "Thanks for the heads up, too."
Suddenly, the threat scope lit up like a gaudy Christmas wreath. A missile launch warning soon followed. It wasn't coming from Milo. There was another fighter out there, and it was attacking them. He spotted it at that instant. It was a damn B-52 bomber, but it was like no B-52 he'd ever seen before. The strange bomber sported a long, wedge-shaped fairing on its upper fuselage, resembling a specialized radar compartment. And he saw pylons between the fuselage and the inboard engine nacelles, with what looked like AIM-120 air-to-air missiles installed. The F-16D fighter that had taken off with Mirisch and Milo had fallen in beside the bomber, obviously to get a closer look. Damn it, Mirisch cursed to himself. Whatever that plane was out there, it had killed them both.
"All right, General," Hal Jarrell exclaimed. "What the hell do you call this thing?"
"The Mega Fortress Plus, Cal," Elliot said with unabashed pride, "now designated the EB-52C Mega Fortress Strategic Flying Battleship. Strategic escort, defense suppression, anti-radar, anti-ship strategic and tactical jamming, and long-range air interdiction aircraft."
"Air interdiction? You mean it shoots down other aircraft?"
Elliot replied proudly. "It got your AWACS plane, maybe even one of the Wildcats, a flying battleship."
"They're classified under the Strategic Air Reserve Fleet. But they're ready for combat, and the best place to try them out is the Strategic Warfare Center," Jarrell said.
"General Jarrell, you wouldn't happen to know of any organization that could benefit from the use of a few highly sophisticated bombers such as these, would you?"
"Are you kidding, sir?" Jarrell exclaimed. "These things are perfect for the air battle force."
"I'm glad you see it my way, Cal," Elliot said. I think we can do business.
Strategic Air Command Headquarters, Offutt Air Force Base. General Larry T. Tyler, Commander-in-Chief of the Strategic Air Command, was getting ready to make his first serve of his tennis match when the beeper on his portable radio went off. Tyler's driver immediately started up the general staff car. In Tyler's footsteps was his doubles partner, Major General Richard Ratkiller Stone, who was to become Tyler's Deputy Chief of Staff of Pacific Operations in a few weeks.
"Let's go, Ratkiller, in my car. We'll have a little impromptu on-the-job training," Tyler said. "We got a zero-tango notification," Tyler told Stone.
They were approaching SAC headquarters, a low, generally unimpressive building in the center of the base.
"Keep your badge in sight and follow me in, Rat," Tyler told Stone. "We might have to put you up in the press box, but you're certainly cleared inside the command post."
Stone blinked at the four-star general.
You don't know what's happening, sir."
A grim-faced expression from Tyler gave Stone his answer. Tyler hit the mic button on his console.
"Alpha in position. Log me in, please, and let's get started."
A voice on the auditorium's loudspeaker immediately chimed in.
"Major Helton, sir, with an Event 1 situation briefing."
Helton was this ship's assistant chief of intelligence.
"Approximately 15 minutes ago, Space Command was alerted by a forest green nuclear detonation warning sensor on three different Navstar satellites. By authority of SYNC Spacecom, an Event 1 warning was issued to us and to JCS, and a zero-tango conference initiated. Spacecom is currently reporting a high probability of a nuclear explosion in the South China Sea region near the Philippines."
"Estimate on yield?"
"No official reading yet, sir."
Tyler couldn't believe it. A real nuclear detonation.
"When was the Pentagon notified, and what did they say?"
"NCA was notified 5 minutes ago by Space Command directly, sir,"
Halverson replied.
"They're assembling the commands for a teleconference."
"Any idea when we can get real-time pictures of the area?" Stone asked.
"I'm sure the request is being made right now, sir," the tech replied.
On screen, on the big board, the frozen image was displayed. The vessel was huge, with two stacks, two center-mounted antenna masts, several anti-ship missile canisters behind the forecastle, and a helicopter deck aft with a small hangar.
"Ulagan Bay," Stone said.
He turned to a technician seated beside him.
"I recognize that harbor. Ulagan Bay, the Philippines, but that big ship, Hong Long," he said immediately. "He's the Chinese destroyer Hong Long. It's the flagship of the Spratly Island Flotilla."
There was a long pause then.
"Well, you're right about the Philippines," Tyler said. "But what's the Spratly Islands?"
"It's a small island chain in the South China Sea," Stone replied. "China occupies the lower one-third. The Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia and Malaysia occupy the northern third, with the middle third a neutral zone. Those five countries have been fighting over the islands for decades."
"Well, the fighting has just reached a new level, right?" Tyler said dryly. "Doesn't look like they set off a nuke right near the Philippines just a few minutes ago."
Stone replied, "It's a well-known fact that the EF-5-class destroyers carry at least two Fei Lung 9 anti-ship cruise missiles with RK-55 warheads. I'd say it was the Chinese Fei Lung 9 launched from the Hong Lung that went off, General." Stone could see Tyler shaking his head in amazement. In a few minutes, the President of the United States was going to get on the line with Tyler and ask him how he should respond. That call came a few moments later, but not from the President.
"All stations, this is Renegade on Zero Tango Action, teleconference network. Security classification top secret. All stations stand by. Network poll in progress. National Command Authority, White House."
"General Tyler, SAC," Tyler interrupted the Space Command briefer. "My staff expert has possibly determined the origin of the nuclear detonation."
"Go ahead, SAC."
"My staff has determined that the most likely suspect is the People's Republic of China," Tyler replied.
"I think we're getting ahead of ourselves here," Navy Admiral Kenneth Stovall responded irritably. "You can't lay the blame on anyone, especially the Chinese, without absolute positive proof."
"Excuse me, Admiral," Tyler interrupted. "We've already determined that it was an RK-55 warhead launched on a Fei Lung 9 anti-ship missile from the Chinese destroyer."
"What is the current status of your units at this time, General Tyler?" General Curtis, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs at the Pentagon, asked.
"Sir, I'm showing 100% of the force fully mission ready," Tyler said. "The force is currently under posture 4. However, please be aware that the current plan has no contingencies for operations in the East Asian region. We hold no Chinese targets at risk.
Understood, Curtis replied. It may be premature to declare an A-hour, however. We will defer that decision.
Where do you need me? Stone asked.
Right with me, rat killer, Tata replied. You're my resident Philippine expert.
I'm ready, Stone said. Is there any time to get out of these sweats, though?
Don't worry about it, Tyler said. Everyone here will be just as nervous and sweaty as you are. Except it won't be from exercise, it'll be from good old fear.
The Presidential Palace, Manila, the Philippines.
Where in hell is the President?
Daniel Tequina asked irritably. The Philippine First Vice President was joined by the Deputy Vice President and the Cabinet. It took several minutes, but finally President Arturo Micaso entered the conference chamber.
A terrible tragedy has occurred,
Micaso began solemnly.
Less than 30 minutes ago, a patrol task force was attacked by a Republic of China patrol in Filipino waters. During the naval confrontation, the Chinese flagship, a destroyer, launched a nuclear-tipped anti-ship missile. Our warships were on our side of the neutral zone boundary.
I do not believe the Chinese launched that missile, the Guinness said adamantly.
Why do you defend the Chinese?
One of the other cabinet ministers asked.
The evidence seems clear.
Do you deny that nuclear weapons were once stored here in the Philippines for the use of the U.S. Navy and Air Force?
What are you talking about, Tegina?
Micaso shouted.
There are no nuclear weapons on Filipino soil. It was a Filipino vessel that was destroyed, for God's sake.
Do you deny that there were still American intelligence agents here in the Philippines?
Tegina asked. This Micaso could not deny, because Tegina occasionally did some work for the American CIA. Micaso hesitated. The cabinet officers looked at each other, then at Micaso with undisguised shock.
Then it is true?
One of the cabinet officers gasped. Tegina chuckled aloud.
You have much to answer for, old man, he said haughtily.
Always with the brave speeches, Micaso said wittily. Leadership is more than speeches and tough words, Michael. We'll see who is the better leader, old man, Tegina said, and walked quickly out.
The room was very quiet after Tegina's departure. The White House Situation Room.
What do you mean we didn't see what happened?
The President of the United States, Lloyd Zachary Taylor, blurted out.
You suspect a nuclear explosion, and we don't know where or who set it off?
The Situation Room fell very, very quiet. The President let his eyes wander around the table to each of his advisors assembled there. Thomas Preston, the Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Air Force General Wilbur Curtis, Kenneth Wayne, Director of the Central Intelligence, and Frank Kellogg, the National Security Advisor.
General Curtis, what have you got for me?
The President asked. As I mentioned before, sir, one of our nuclear detection satellites recorded a nuclear explosion near the Philippines a short time ago, Curtis replied.
So didn't the satellite see who launched the missile?
The satellite carried intensity and radiation sensors only, sir, Curtis replied. We cannot be more specific until we get more information from our DST satellites, and that might take several more hours.
All right, the President said wearily. We detected a nuclear explosion, but we have no verification as of yet. Have we spoken with anyone in the Philippines?
We haven't been in contact with Manila yet, sir,
Kenneth Wayne replied.
Phone lines are jammed solid, and all satellite and HF networks have been disrupted.
I'd say that was full verification that something serious has happened out there, Mr. President,
General Curtis interjected.
Mr. President, both the Chinese and the Philippines, as well as Indonesia, Malaysia, and Vietnam, patrol the Spratly Islands all the time, Wayne said. We photographed warships out there for years.
The Chinese warships carry nuclear weapons, sir, Curtis cut in.
He turned to Thomas Preston and said,
so what do we need to send in to check this thing out, Thomas?
We are extremely vulnerable in this region, sir, Preston began. It will be important for us to act quickly and decisively to control developments in the area. The only two carrier battle groups available are Independence and Ranger. Ranger still does not have Hornet fighter bombers because of her accelerated decommissioning schedule. But Independence is fully combat ready, Curtis added. It is suggested that we augment the task force by forming the 1st Air Battle Wing at Anderson Air Force Base on Guam.
Who's in this air battle wing? The President asked.
The wing is a collection of strike aircraft, mostly heavy bombers, plus tankers, fighters, and cargo planes, Curtis replied. The Air Battle Force is a single, self-contained combat unit that can operate from remote areas and over long distances on very short notice.
When I give the word, General, the President said sternly, not before. I'll authorize one carrier battle group to head towards the area where the explosion was detected. They have to take no military action unless I specifically authorize it. As for this air battle thing, it's out of the question, the President continued. A few more items, sir, Curtis added quickly. I'd like permission to deploy the Strat-4 to Guam.
Now, what? Jesus, you guys live for new acronyms, don't you? Speak English, please.
The Strat-4, sir, the Strategic Forces Unit, Curtis explained. They're the advanced team for the Air Battle Force. The President thought about it for a moment. Okay, they can deploy to Guam. The White House Oval Office, several hours later. The President was alone again with Thomas Preston, Secretary of State, Dana Hall, and with Richard Benson, the Attorney General of the United States.
I'm disturbed by the lack of communications into the Philippines, Dana Hall said. I think it'll be important for you to voice your support for Arturo Picasso's government.
Absolutely.
It will be important to separate our support for Picasso from that of Tagina without alienating any one person or office, Benson added. Tagina's a hothead. Muslim radicals in the South Philippines are just as bad.
Second Vice President, what's his name, Samar?
He's a Muslim, right?
Satellite imagery of the Philippines, sir, Preston said. This is Palawan, an island province. I'm not a photo interpreter, sir, but I think you can make out the devastation here. You can see several vessels capsized here and here.
We should find out what the Chinese government is saying about all this, the President said.
The call from Premier Chung should come through any minute, sir, Dana Hall replied. Just then, the interoffice phone rang, and Chief of Staff Paul Caesar picked it up and listened intently for several seconds.
They got through to the embassy in Manila, Caesar said breathlessly. The ambassador is all right. Picasso's been on television, and he seems well. Things appear to be under control.
Hot damn, the President said. Let me speak to the ambassador. Buena Vista Hospital, Ulagan Bay, Palawan Province, the Philippines, that same time. Admiral Yin Po Lun awoke to find himself lying in a very soft bed. Through blurred eyes, he saw several nurses, Filipino nurses. One of them ran off out of sight. A wave of people pushed their way into Yin's room. The wall of onlookers and guards parted suddenly, revealing a tall young man. The man stepped up to Yin's bed, then said in rather good Chinese, "Welcome, Admiral."
"I am First Vice President of the Republic of the Philippines, Daniel Francisco Tagina, Admiral Yin Po Lun. I welcome you to Palawan."
"I will speak of nothing until I am reunited with my officers and receive a report from them," Yin said.
"You will have what you wish, Admiral Yin," Tagina said. "Then we will speak of the future of the Philippines and of our future."
End of Side 2. Joint Chiefs of Staff Conference Center 2 days later. If General Curtis had been expecting a quiet moment before heading into Washington, he would be disappointed. On returning to his office, his aide, Colonel Wyatt, entered and told him,
"You have a couple of visitors, sir."
"Who is it?"
"Sinksack, General Tyler,"
Wyatt replied. "Tyler? He came to Washington without letting me know first?"
"He said it was urgent,"
Wyatt said.
"He brought a few advisors, Dr. John Masters for one."
"Just tell Tyler that Masters will have to wait outside. Who's the other advisor?" Wyatt smiled and replied,
"He asked me to give you a message, sir. The gentleman said he was, quote, going to use his stump to kick your lazy butt all the way to Kavaznia," end quote, sir.
"You're shitting me. Brad Elliott, he's here? Get them in here. No, screw it. I'll go. Bring some coffee or some sugar pills or something. Damn it, Andy, why don't you say something?"
Elliott took a deep breath, slapped Curtis on the chest, and turned him around to face Tyler and Masters.
"General Curtis, this is Dr. John Masters. Dr. Masters, this is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We've got to talk to you, Wilbur, right now."
"I wish I had time to talk with you guys," Curtis said. "But I got a meeting with the CNO in 1 hour and a meeting at the White House right after that."
"It can't wait, Wilbur,"
Elliott said. "I'm afraid it'll have to wait," Curtis insisted. Elliott stepped closer to Curtis.
"Young Dr. Masters there got pictures of a Chinese destroyer launching a nuclear missile at a Philippine patrol boat."
Curtis felt his jaw drop open in surprise.
"How the hell do you know about that?"
"Don't look at me, sir," Tyler said. "I didn't know about Masters until Elliott brought him to me 2 days ago. But Masters has got solid evidence."
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff jabbed a thumb back towards his open office door. "Inside, all of you." He saw Wyatt heading towards his office, intercepted him and told him, "Call Caesar and Mitchell. Tell him I have a change in the agenda for this morning's meeting. Find out where the joint staff is and have them stand by for a meeting in 30 minutes.
the President's residence, Manila, the Philippines, that same moment. Daniel Taguina was ushered into President Arturo Micaso's residence, then left alone in front of Micaso's office. Taguina straightened his tie and his shoulders and knocked on the door. After receiving a curt, "Come," he entered. "What is your report, Daniel?" Micaso said finally. "I have nothing to report." "You spent 2 days in Palawan. Do you have a report for me?" Micaso asked. Taguina reached over, grabbed Micaso by the lapels of his jacket, and pushed him back into a seat. He then yelled, "Admiral, enter!" Picasso, his chest heaving, was horrified to see a contingent of Chinese troops rush into his office. Behind them all was a Chinese naval officer. Beside the military officer, to Picasso's complete surprise, was the ambassador from the People's Republic of China, Dong Sen Kim. Along with the Chinese troops came several of Picasso's cabinet officials, most of whom were National Democratic Front members, but they also included Eduardo Fresquino, the Minister of the Interior. "This is the new governor of the People's Republic of the Sulu Islands, Eduardo Fresquino," Taguina said to Micaso. Micaso stared in disbelief at Fresquino.
"Eduardo, what in God's name are you doing?"
To Taguina, he said,
"You're insane."
"Silence, Micaso, or we will have you silenced," Taguina said.
"Join traitors and armed invaders? I would rather die first."
"Micaso," Taguina said, "you will be confined until you are prepared to give a statement, confessing your crimes and exposing the American agents in the government."
Chinese troops dragged Micaso away. A machine gun blast rang out. Taguina ducked nearly into a full crouch. Admiral Yin seemed not to even hear the gunfire.
"What was that?"
Taguina asked, staring at Yin's impassive face.
"What the hell did you do?"
"You would agree, Comrade President, that the revolution would have been threatened should the traitorous Micaso be allowed to leave."
Taguina was paralyzed with shock, and paralyzed with the reality that this ruthless foreigner had just made him the new president of the Republic of the Philippines. Taguina's eyes registered dark stains spattered across the walls of the hallway outside. The doors of the president's office were closed, and he began planning the important next steps to consolidating his power. The White House Oval Office 2 hours later. "Sir, we can brief you in 10 minutes, Curtis said. "We'll stand by for your decision afterwards." General Curtis motioned to John Masters beside him. "Mr. President, Dr. Masters operates a private launch firm in Arkansas." Curtis motioned to Brad Elliott, who continued.
"Mr. President, at the exact same time as the incident in the South China Sea, my organization was conducting a test of one of Dr. Masters' satellite systems, a remarkable network that transmits images in near real time to strategic bombers. The satellite was supposed to take pictures of the bomb-run area, then transmit it to a B-2. Instead, the satellite transmitted pictures of what took place in the South China Sea the moment before the nuclear explosion occurred."
Kenneth Mitchell interjected. "You got pictures of the explosion?"
"Dr. Masters has a presentation that will enlighten us all," Curtis said.
"Dr. Masters?" No response.
"John?" "Sorry, sir. I'll advance the shots. Watch. I've set it in on the Chinese destroyer. Right here. They just launched a missile. It goes supersonic and ballistic immediately, gliding straight to the Filipino ships on its left flank."
Master stepped the images ahead until the missile was near impact.
"And here's where it hits. Here. Now the satellite is detecting what it thinks is an extremely hot mountain right where seconds earlier was a cold ocean. The images then go blank, and the satellite's sensors shut down. Fortunately, the satellite was able to download its data to the Black Knight bomber just before it went into full system reset."
He turned to the president and said,
"That's what a thermonuclear explosion looks like to a computer."
The president's expression did not change much.
"This was very interesting, Doctor. Is there some way we can copy this recording, you know, for analysis?"
"I've brought John Masters here for a reason," General Elliott said. "Mr. President, I brought him here because he has the know-how to provide us with instant reconnaissance data on what's going on out there. I think we should use these satellites to..."
"That's enough, General," the President said.
"I'm not sure you understand, Mr. President," General Curtis interjected. "The carrier battle group you sent to the Philippines is in even greater danger than we thought. The Chinese have nuclear weapons in the Philippines and are willing to use them."
"General Curtis,"
the President's tone was flat, "Arturo Micaso is dead."
"Machine gunned down in the presidential palace," Dana Hall, the Secretary of State, added. "Killed in cold blood after he had been taken into custody by Vice President Daniel Taguina." Curtis was dumbstruck. "Mr. President, I'm very sorry for my outburst. I have no idea. Maybe we should leave." I think Dr. Masters should be excused. The president stood and extended a hand to John Masters. Very nice to meet you, Dr. Masters. We're very grateful. After Masters had departed, the president sank into his chair. Well, what the hell do we do now, he said. Mr. President, our first concern should be the Independence Carrier Group, Kenneth Mitchell said. The group may be in danger. Sending in a second carrier battle group seems pretty provocative to me, Caesar said. I think that action can be fully justified, Curtis replied. So would sending in the air battle force for support. So what can the Air Force do, the president asked. We don't have bases in the Philippines. We'd operate out of Guam, sir, Curtis replied. We'd recommend deploying the SAC Stratfor, the senior air combat planning staff. General Tyler has a team standing by ready to go. Afterwards, we send in the 1st Air Battle Wing to protect the naval forces and clear a path for further operations. At present, I am nominating Lieutenant General Richard Stone as Stratfor commander. General Stone knows the Philippines inside and out. It was he who initially identified the main Chinese destroyer. Stratfor makes its recommendations to Pacific Command on the type of response necessary. Who makes its recommendations? To you. Once approval is granted from you through Pacific Command, the Stratfor will form the air battle force under one commander. The president shook his head and said, hold on, you want me to authorize this? Curtis was dumbfounded. Excuse me, Mr. President, but we've already talked about... I know, and I'm ready to respond, the president said, but not with this air battle force thing. I'll authorize your Stratfor to conduct reconnaissance missions over the Philippines. Yes, sir. I also suggest that we use the Ranger and Independence Carrier groups to provide air cover for the reconnaissance planes, Curtis said. Air cover? I said no air operations. This would be for the Stratfor reconnaissance jets, sir, Curtis explained. Do it with less, the president said. General Tyler, General Elliott, good to see you both. Thank you for your input. Mr. Caesar will show you gentlemen out. A Secret Service agent arrived to escort the officers to the door. They were reunited with John Masters. Curtis led the group downstairs to the Situation Room. Curtis had Tyler sign everyone in with the security guard. I think Dr. Masters can help you, Larry, Elliott said. What do you think, John? 2 constellations of 6 relay satellites and 5 Pacer Skybirds? Masters was suddenly in motion. He gave Brad Elliott a sarcastic frown. He turned to Tyler and said, General, I can have your own real-time scrambled satellite communications relay constellation set up by the time your Stratfor arrives in Guam.
This is no time for a commercial announcement, Dr. Masters, Curtis said.
He's not bragging, Will, but he's dead serious, Elliott interjected. Tyler nodded enthusiastically.
How long can you wait to get all this gear in place?
Masters shrugged. Seriously, it'll take about 72 hours to get my satellites in orbit and get the ground equipment in place. My only problem is this. Who's going to pay for all this?
I think, Elliott said with a sly grin, that Hawk can come up with a few bucks to get your stuff moving in the right direction.
Your handshake will be good enough for me, Masters said. It's a business doing pleasure with you, General. One phone call and they'll load a couple of my DC-10s with boosters and satellites and get them ready to fly. Brad, if I can get you to call Space Command and grease the skids for me, I'll have my staff send in launch window and range clearance requests over White Sands.
Anderson Air Force Base, Guam.
Man, living in Arkansas, I thought I knew what humidity felt like, John Masters said.
General Brad Elliott had to agree. Although he had spent some months in Guam during the Vietnam War, he never got accustomed to the oppressive humidity on the tiny, isolated tropical island. Masters had already launched 2 air-launched alert response missile boosters while still over the United States, after receiving approval from the U.S. government and his board of directors for the project. The young scientist and engineer was excited about his participation in the project, but that excitement didn't carry to most of his staff and his board of directors. The White House Oval Office, Washington, D.C. The president was receiving his first official visitor of the day, Hao Sung Yugao, Chinese ambassador to the United States. Tea was poured.
We have heard reports from Japan and Hong Kong of numerous deaths as a result of persons eating radiation-poisoned fish, the president began. We have heard little from your government. Premier Chung has not contacted me directly. Your actions in the Philippines are cause for great concern in our country. Do you have a message for this government?
Mr. President, Ambassador Hao said, the government of China
found itself torn between a monstrous event and a request for assistance that came because of the incident. Our government had no choice but to act.
The president replied, I want the government of China to make a public announcement clearly outlining your objectives in the Philippines. I want China to reduce the number of troops it has in the Philippines by one half within 30 days. I also want Arturo Vicoso to be released from custody or his body turned over to the United States. And I want those responsible brought to trial. Do you have anything further for me, Mr. Ambassador?
The Chinese ambassador to the United States remained impassive.
I will convey your requests and concerns to Comrade Premier Zhong, personally.
Aboard the Navy F-14A Tomcat Fighter Bullet 4.
This ship was happening too fast,
Lieutenant Greg Hitman Povich thought. No sooner had they finished refueling than they were transferred to the Air Force E-3 AWACS radar planes controller. The Navy guys had trained a few times with Air Force controllers, but they still used different terminology. After filtering the chatter, Povich and his wingman in Bullet 5 were vectored into visual range of an Air Force RC-135 reconnaissance plane. Just then they heard on the International Guard radio channel,
Unidentified aircraft at 10,000 meters altitude. This is Fighter Unit 7.
Unknown aircraft, you have violated restricted airspace. You are not responding. Decrease velocity. Lower your landing gear and follow us or you will be attacked. This is your final warning.
Povich considered shutting off guard channel, but he might need it later. Povich had a decision to make right now. Their primary mission was to protect the Air Force recon plane. They needed to get those Chinese fighters turned away from the Air Force heavies.
Pull in flight, four bandits turning to intercept. Now at your 2 o'clock position, 40 miles. Second flight of bandits confirmed at Angels 10. Pull in flight, two bandits peeling off from the pursuit, returning to heading 150 to intercept on flashlight.
Pull in two flight, can you get the four inbounds?
Povich called.
Affirmative, hitman.
The pilot of Bullet 2 replied using Povich's call sign.
Bullet flight, be advised. Bullet 6 flight of 2 airborne,
the AWACS control reported. Two more Tomcats are on the way. Well, Povich thought grimly, everybody was paired up and the dancing was going to begin. Strat 4 Command Post, Anderson Air Force Base, Guam.
Message from the basket, sir, an operator reported. They report 6 enemy fighters engaging the F-14 escorts 300 miles northwest of Manado. Flashlight is withdrawing from the area.
General Stone was on his feet in a heartbeat. Elliot was behind him.
Tell Flashlight to dump that data and get the hell out of there. Shamu should stay available for emergency refueling, and Basket should stay to control the intercepts. What we need, Stone said half aloud, is permission to launch an attack from Ranger. Unfortunately, that's pretty unlikely, Elliot said. Unless, of course, one of our recon planes gets shot down.
Aboard Bullet 4.
5 minutes to bingo,
Povich Rio said.
Time to get out of here.
A few more turns and then we'll bug out, Povich said. I need to make sure those bozos on us can't go after that recon plane.
Bullet! Bullet 2 flight is engaging the other two bandits,
the AWACS control reported.
You've got 2, possibly 4 more bandits northwest of your position, closing at 600 knots.
That was all Povich was waiting for.
Copy, Basket.
Povich had just started his hard left turn when he heard his wingman scream,
Missile launch! Hitman, missile on you!
Shit, Povich cursed. Gimme Chap and Flash Bear, find that missile.
I can't see it!
Bear Blevin, as Rio shouted.
I can't see it!
He could see each flare cartridge flying into the darkness, but not the enemy missile.
Hitman, his wingman shouted. On your left, hit your burners!
Blevin fought the G-forces and stared out the left side, then he saw the missile immediately. Povich jammed both throttles to max afterburner. It was a last-ditch move to defeat the heat-seeking missile that was locked onto his tail.
Blevin cried out, Jesus!
But just as he expected the missile to hit, he could see it veer to the right and pass behind them.
God damn, it's past us! I can't see anymore!
He searched both sides of his Tomcat to make sure it wasn't circling to re-attack.
Bullet 4, bandits turning right away from you,
the AWACS controller reported.
Bullet 5, bandit moving across your nose at 6 miles. 4 is well clear at your 5 o'clock position low.
Bullet 5, Fox 2,
Povich's wingman cried out. The heat-seeking AIM-9R Sidewinder missiles curled to the right and dipped lower. Seconds later, there were 2 explosions. The damaged Chinese fighter began to cartwheel to the ocean.
Bullet 5, splash 1,
the AWACS controller reported.
Bullet 5 is 3 minutes to bingo,
Povich's wingman added.
I can take a vector to Bullet 2 flight if they need help. Don't think that'll be necessary, Bullet 5,
The AWACS controller said, "Home plate wants you to RTB. Heading 132, stand by for your approach controller." Aboard Bullet 2. "Take the shot, Banger," Lieutenant Commander Carl Roberts shouted. "Take the damn shot." "Bullet 2 is engaging," Douglas cried out on the interplane frequency. He snapped his Tomcat into a steep left rolling dive. Roberts coached his front seater in. "Range 20 miles, good tone, clear to shoot." "Fox 1," Douglas called out as he pressed the button to launch a Sparrow missile. He was preparing to arm up a second one when he saw several long tongues of flame slash across the darkness. There was no mistaking it. 8 huge missiles were being launched by the Chinese fighters.
"Missile launch! Bandits launching missiles! 6, 7, 8 of them! Big ones!"
"Bullet 3 has a duty on the missiles," Douglas' wingman suddenly shouted. "I'm going after them."
"Bullet 2 is clearing off the missiles,"
Douglas radioed.
"Bullet 2 is clear!"
The incoming Tomcat pilots immediately let loose with a 4-missile barrage of Phoenix missiles. Suddenly, a huge explosion erupted in the sky ahead of Douglas as one of the Phoenix missiles found its target.
"Splash 1, Bandit! Bullet 2's got the other one!"
Roberts cried out.
"Bullet 2, disengage!"
the AWACS controller called.
"I show you 4 past your bingo!"
Douglas and Roberts could do nothing else but head back to Ranger and hope they still had a deck to land on as they listened to the chase unfold. Aboard the cruiser USS Bunker Hill, Lieutenant Commander Paul Hart was the Bunker Hill's tactical action officer, and the Aegis system was his pride and joy. Hart was in his element in the dark, rather claustrophobic confines of the CIC.
"Yes, sir," Hart exclaimed. "That B-6 must have got in before Bullet 3 could take a shot. It was a long-range snapshot, too. He must have been carrying PL-9 missiles."
Captain Richard Feynman stared at Hart in complete surprise. Hart continued.
"Those C-601 missiles got past both the Tomcats and the Phoenix missiles."
Hart turned to the tactical alert intercom and radioed,
"Bridge, CIC, I show 4 inbounds, Charlie 601 anti-ship missiles. Bridge, CIC, emergency, request permission to release batteries 4 and aft and engage."
Bunker Hill skipper didn't hesitate.
"Bridge to CIC, batteries released, 4 and aft, clear to engage." "Understand, clear to engage, clear forward and aft missile decks, clear forward and aft missile decks. Missile counting down, 10 missiles in the green, missile 1 forward and 5, 4... 3, 2, 1, launch, missiles away."
Up on the forward deck of the Bunker Hill, a 25-inch square white door popped open atop the MK-41 VLS launcher. Once every 2 seconds, an Aegis SM-2 missile lifted free of the Bunker Hill, climbed to 10,000 feet in just a few seconds, and then arched over and began its intercept.
"Counting down on aft launcher, in 3, 2, 1, mark."
The canister door on the aft launcher flipped open and the first SM-2 fired. But something happened. Instead of shooting skyward, the SM-2 missile rose about 20 feet above the launcher, the solid propellant motor stopped running, and the missile slipped backwards, crashed to the deck, and exploded. The concussion threw half of the Aegis crew members to the deck. Feynman was the only one able to react. He hit the hold fire button.
"Status report," he cried out. "Get me a status report."
Hart's ears were ringing hard.
"Mark 7 system is faulted. Both launchers shut down. Bridge, CIC, Mark 7 system fault. Recommend immediate AAW command transfer."
"CIC, Bridge, copy. Command transfer to Sterrett."
The transfer was made, but far too late. 3 C-601 anti-ship missiles survived the Aegis counterattack made by Bunker Hill. 2 missiles were destroyed by the Phalanx close-in weapon system. The last missile hit the carrier Ranger just after the port bow. The missile's nose cap pierced the outer hull of the carrier before the warhead detonated, ensuring that most of the missile's deadly force was directed inside the vessel. The Pentagon. The National Military Command Center was a large, sophisticated command post where members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and members of the National Command Authority and National Security Council could monitor crisis developments anywhere in the world. General Wilbur Curtis trotted in and took his place in the front row center seat. Beside him was Paul Caesar, the President's Chief of Staff. Curtis gave him a brief nod as he clicked on the microphone at his seat. "Curtis here. Situation report, please." Navy Captain Rebecca Rogers' voice came over the NMCC's loudspeaker.
"About 15 minutes ago, the aircraft carrier Ranger, her escort, several Navy fighters, and an Air Force reconnaissance plane were attacked by Chinese land-based fighters and bombers south of the Philippines."
"My God," Caesar murmured.
"Current casualty report. 47 dead, 200 injured. Ranger still afloat, heading to Manado in Indonesia at minimum speed.
Aegis cruiser Bunker Hill damaged during action, Rogers continued, but sustained no casualties and only minor injuries. It is fully combat capable and is assisting Ranger.
Action approved, Curtis said. Damn it. Bunker Hill, too. Two major warships damaged. Wait one. Wasn't there another ship with Ranger? Another cruiser?
Yes, sir. USS Sturt is en route to the Celebes Sea to attempt to recover two F-14 fighters downed in action with the Chinese fighter bombers. The Tomcat cruiser listed as missing in action.
Damn it, Captain. Any more casualties? One shock is enough.
No, sir. American casualties only on Ranger and the two Tomcats.
The orange light on his console illuminated. Curtis here. Hold for the President, please. A moment later.
Yes, Wilbur. What's going on?
Mr. President, we have an incident near the Philippines. The aircraft carrier Ranger was hit by a Chinese air-launched cruise missile and damaged with loss of life. Two Navy fighter planes were shot down as well.
Oh, crap, the President murmured. I'll be out of here in 10 minutes. The line went dead.
To his communications officer, Curtis said, call the White House and get the NSC in the Situation Room ASAP. The next call came from Guam.
General Stone here, sir.
Curtis asked, do they own the Celebes Sea Rat Killer?
I'm afraid so, sir, Stone replied. Air, land, sea, everything. We gotta go in hard if we want to have access.
Curtis knew what that meant.
I copy. Looks like Dr. Master's gadgets are going to be the only intel we get for a while.
He's giving us some great poop, sir, Stone said. His gadgets are working just fine. You should have some more detailed shots of the Chinese positions in Zamboanga within a couple of hours.
Listen, Rat Killer, it hasn't been approved yet, but I think I can get the boss to send in the 1st Air Battle Wing. Start factoring them in your plans as fast as you can.
I've got about 3 different plans built, Stone replied. We need all the hardware we can get our hands on.
The White House Situation Room, 30 minutes later.
You told me the carrier groups could protect themselves, General, the President began.
Sir, there was a malfunction of one SM-2 Aegis missile during the cruise of Bunker Hill's response, Curtis explained. Bunker Hill had positive control of the situation until the time of the mishap.
What I need now is some advice, people. We'll send an official protest, but what else do we do? Do we send in the independence of the B-52s, the President asked.
Sir, it's even more important to send the air battle force in right now, Curtis continued, because they now become the only offensive weapon we have against the Chinese and the Philippines. We've found a weakness that I think we can exploit without exposing any additional naval forces to attack. The plans require using the air battle force. The air battle force is the only unit we can send on short notice that has the firepower we need. I think Masters has developed a workable plan for dealing with the Chinese in the South Philippines.
Just let me know what you're proposing to send over there, the President said irritably.
The 1st Air Battle Wing, Curtis replied, consists of 18 B-52 bombers, 6 B-1B bombers, 10 F-111G bombers, 20 F-15B, C, and E model fighters, 12 F-4 fighters, 3 KC-10 tankers, 6 KC-135 tankers, 1 E-3C AWACS plane, 1 RC-135 radar plane, 1 EC-135 airborne command post, 3 C-5 cargo planes, and 10 C-141 cargo planes. It totals about 2,000 men and women. The current force includes 3 B-2 stealth bombers, but no plans have been made to include them in any operation. According to our intelligence figures, the Chinese have approximately 10,000 troops in Zamboanga itself, plus another 5,000 afloat in the Celebes Sea.
Wait a minute, the President said in complete surprise. You want to take on 15,000 Chinese troops with only 2,000 men? That's it?
Sir, numbers don't make the difference here, Curtis explained. The air battle force has the striking power of 2, perhaps 3 aircraft carrier battle groups, and they have speed and flexibility that the carriers themselves don't. We have the air power to force the Chinese out of Zamboanga and perhaps out of the South Philippines altogether. I recommend to you that we activate the air battle force and deploy them to Guam. Once they're there, we can present a more detailed plan to you.
Mr. President, I'm ready to brief you at any time, Curtis added. But it was clear the President wasn't ready to challenge anyone.
I'm sorry, Wilbur, the President said, but I can't authorize such a large force in this situation.
So, we've got to make some sort of response, Curtis said.
I have three other small-scale possibilities for you to consider. A single flight of B-52s from Castle Air Force Base in California. The president shook his head again with eyes averted. A second possibility, the Wisconsin Battle Group. Six ships led by the battleship Wisconsin. How long will it take to get that group to the area? Perhaps as long as a week. The president considered the idea then. Authorized. I want a briefing as soon as possible. Anything else? Yes, sir. The 2nd Marine Pre-Positioning Force based on Mariana Island near Guam. It'll take at least 5 days for this group to arrive on station. This decision came a bit faster. Authorized. That's all I can do, Wilbur. I don't want either group closer than 500 miles to the Philippines without my direct order. Understood?
Yes, sir.
The president stood. I'm going to announce the news about the Rangers to the White House press corps. Excuse me. The president rose and left the Situation Room. Outside ASEAN headquarters, Singapore, the Marine Corps driver from the embassy staff quickly stepped around from the driver's side to the curbside rear door, opened it, and stood at attention as United Nations Ambassador Deborah O'Day and her aide entered the car. Go ahead and take the Central Avenue to Government House, O'Day's aide said as the driver re-entered the limousine. Call ahead and ask communications to get a line open for us, O'Day said. Corporal, you didn't call the embassy communications office like the ambassador asked. Now please do it. His orders answered with a clunk as the locks on all the doors engaged. A .45 caliber Colt semi-automatic pistol appeared in the hand of the driver. He showed it to O'Day and her aide, but then immediately lowered it out of view. Please sit still and do not try anything foolish, the driver said. You will not be harmed unless you try to resist. What are you going to do with us? Nothing, the driver said. Gripping the .45 in his right hand, he then leaned through the dividing window between the compartments and tossed an object onto the rear seats. O'Day's aide reached for the object as she studied the man. It was impossible to determine his ancestry. The aide examined the object. O'Day saw that it was two military ID cards, paper clipped together. What are these? O'Day asked. Where did you get them? From two F-14 crew members we've retrieved from the Celebes Sea, the man replied. The lieutenant was dead when we found him. The other, Lieutenant Commander Bowen, is injured but still alive. I believe he is known as Cowboy. American Navy pilots? Careers from my government retrieved them from the sea, the man said. I have a message from Second Vice President General Samar. Samar, O'Day exclaimed. Is he still alive? Is he in hiding? Silence, the man said. We have your crew members. General Samar requests help from your government to relieve Davao on the island of Mindanao. He is resisting the Chinese invaders, but cannot hold on for much longer. Please help my people. The man stepped out of the car and ran away as fast as he could. Bujada Peninsula, southeastern Mindanao, the Philippines. The only warmth Lieutenant Commander Paul Cowboy Bowman had felt in 2 days came from a tiny burning white fuel tablet. He had lit the tablet with a match, placed it in a small cook stove from a survival kit, then folded a sheet of an old Tagalog-language magazine cover into a shallow pan, filled it with brackish water, and set it on the stove. To Second Vice President Jose Trujillo Samar's surprise, the paper pan did not burn. The water in the paper pan began to boil. Bowman took a sip. Try some, General, he asked Samar. The rebel leader shook his head. I have tasted your American emergency rations. I have had my fill. Even though the man was smiling, the tone of his voice described a very unpleasant experience. Bowman was getting a taste of being on the run himself. Ever since being fished out of the Celebes Sea by a fishing boat and being delivered to Samar's militia, he had been on the run. He had not slept for almost 3 days now, and his left elbow was probably broken when it hit the cockpit sill on ejection. Samar himself had showed up only late last night. His militiamen treated him like Caesar. It was Samar who ordered Bowman to be untied and for him to be allowed to use the items in his survival kit. What are you going to do with me, us? Bowman asked Samar. I do not know, Samar asked. The Chinese are all around us. Be silent. He raised his rifle, scanning the skies to the east, then stopped. Bowman followed his gaze. Chinese patrol helicopters. Pray they haven't found us. Silence. Stay here. 3 men are running north to create a diversion. The rest say they will fight. Run for your life. It seemed they had only been running for a few seconds when suddenly a ripple of explosions behind him threw Bowman to the jungle floor. Stay down! Samar cried. He pressed something into Bowman's hands. It was his PRC-23D survival radio from his survival kit. Use this when the time comes. Start crawling towards the heavy jungle. Stay as hidden as you can,
They're using infrared scanners to find us. Our only hope is to get back into the heavy forest. Now, run!
Marine Corps Captain Fred Collins swung the nose of his MV-22A Sea Hammer tilt-rotor aircraft to line up his Stinger missile system on the infrared image of the Chinese patrol helicopter. He lifted the protective cover off the safety release, pressed the release with his right thumb, got a ready-shoot indication on his integrated helmet display system, then pulled the trigger with his right index finger. Fox 2, Able 07. From less than half a mile away, the kill was quick and spectacular.
Splash one chopper, Collins radioed. I'm coming up on bingo fuel basket, he said. I either chase or continue with the pickup. I can't do both. Where is he now? Bullet, go to rescue one. Over.
Suddenly, radio number two came alive with a distinctive ping, ping tone.
I've got a tone on rescue one, Collins shouted, coming from the area we just left. I think I have something down there. PJ, stand by.
In the rear of the MV-22 tilt-rotor aircraft were four pararescue jumpers, or PJs, wearing rappelling gear. Using their rappelling gear, the PJs edged off the Sea Hammer and slid to the ground. Unslinging their rifles, they took a bearing from the MV-22 and proceeded towards the subject. A few cautious minutes later, they found Bowman.
Abel, this is PJ-1. I got him. Looks like one of our boys. Move in position.
Collins edged the Sea Hammer aircraft forward, and the crewman in the cargo hold lowered a rescue hoist. He unfolded the petal-like seats on the forest penetrator, lifted Bowman up, and secured him into the seat. Bowman had enough strength to wrap his arms around the rescue device and do as he was told.
Samar! Samar! Don't forget Samar!
Bowman told the PJ. Collins was using the FLIR scanner to search the area around the rescue site. Suddenly he stopped.
I got someone else, he said. 30 yards to the right. He's not moving. Check it out.
The second PJ on the ground reached the body.
He looks like a Filipino. Wait, he's wearing General Stars, no name tag.
Collins maneuvered closer to his ground crewman.
General Stars? A General? Samar? Holy shit, I think it might be General Samar, the fucking vice president. Get him on board, damn it, hurry.
Aboard the USS Saratoga in the Philippine Sea. The Philippine national anthem played in the background.
My fellow Filipinos, I am Jose Samar, second vice president of the Republic of the Philippines. I am speaking to you from a control room aboard the American aircraft carrier USS Saratoga, which is en route to Guam. As you can see, I am injured but alive. I was rescued on the 3rd of October by American Marines from the island of Mindanao, shortly after being attacked and nearly killed by patrols from the People's Republic of China. I am formally requesting full military and economic assistance from the government of the United States in helping me to repel the Chinese invaders. Above all, pray for the strength and courage we will need to resist the Chinese invaders. May God give me and you, my loyal brothers and sisters, the strength to continue fighting until our country is once again free.
The White House Oval Office. President Lloyd Taylor stared out the window.
I'm glad Vice President Samar made his statement in time for the news networks to pick it up.
General Wilbur Curtis was the first to speak.
Sir, I want to thank you for authorizing that rescue operation. We arrived just in time. Not only did we save our pilot, but we saved Vice President Samar. Now, Samar has given us the legal keys to his country. The question is, what are we going to do about it?
The President paused for a few moments.
Okay, General Curtis, you got the green light. Get the air battle force moving to Anderson as quickly as possible.
And the B-2 bombers that are part of the air battle force?
The President replied,
that's up to you and your people. If the crews have been training with your air battle force, if they know their shit, you're authorized to send them.
Ellsworth Air Force Base, South Dakota, 3 hours later.
Orders are as follows, ladies and gentlemen, General Jowell began. By order of the President, all elements of the 1st Air Battle Wing have been directed to deploy immediately to Anderson Air Force Base, Guam, and prepare for air operations under the direction of Pacific Command. Commander, 1st Air Battle Wing will be myself, who will report to Lieutenant General Richard Stone immediately upon arrival. Lieutenant General Stone becomes the Joint Task Force Commander effective immediately. No other details were given in the message, but that's all we need to get going.
Group filed out of the auditorium. Gerald returned to his office. In his office were three officers, one of which, a one-star general, he had never met. The two others were Cobb and McClanahan. The general extended his hand to Gerald.
John Ormack, Vice Commander of Hawk. Call me John, please. Carl Gerald, pleased to meet you. He motioned to seats and he took his behind his desk. We have to make this fast, John. I want your planes to accompany the air battle force to Guam. We're not a combat unit, General, Ormack said. We're a research organization.
Major Carr and General McClanahan were two of my best students, Gerald said, and they tell me they were just your average sticks.
You can't provide the kind of security we need, General, Ormack said.
Excuse me, General Ormack, McClanahan had interjected. I recommend we send the Strategic Air Reserve planes.
No way, Patrick.
Sir, we're ready to go, Cobb interjected. We trained our butts off in this place. What do you say?
Ormack looked at Gerald and said,
I'll need approval from General Elliott before I can authorize it.
Gerald picked up the phone.
Get me General Brad Elliott of Anderson.
He handed the phone to Ormack, then turned to Cobb and McClanahan.
Got your gear packed?
Ready and waiting, sir.
Good. See you on Guam.
Over the Philippine Sea, east of Mindanao, the Philippines. Identity confirmed, sir, the Combat Information Center officer on the Chinese destroyer Falin reported. American subsonic spy plane, probably a U-2 or TR-1.
Very well. Let us see if we can get ourselves an American spy plane. Range the target.
Bomb doors coming open. Stand by. Bomb doors open.
This had to be the first time in Patrick McConaughey's memory that he was going to open the bomb doors on his B-2 bomber and not attack something. He and Major Henry Cobb had already flown their B-2 bomber nearly 2,000 miles, all to carry two bulbous objects that would not go boom. The two pods were reconnaissance systems housed in aerodynamic pods that resembled the fighter's standard 330-gallon external fuel tanks. Although the pods were incredibly effective, they had a radar signature thousands of times larger than the B-2 bomber carrying them. Every time they were lowered out of the bomb bay, Cobb and McClanahan lost all their stealth capabilities.
Stand by for pod deploy.
Air search radar got us. 3 o'clock range. Range 40 miles.
As the pod finished its first circular sweep, more details of the area surrounding them appeared, including one very unwelcome one.
Geez, we're surrounded by Chinese patrol boats.
McClanahan commanded the pods to retract immediately before any one of them got a lock on the B-2.
Air target warning. No speed or altitude reading available. Search radar active.
The new radar contact puzzled the destroyer commander, but it was obviously an anomaly. The real quarry was still driving closer.
Status of the U-2.
Range up launching 75 kilometers now.
Very well. Order Kaifeng and Zhang Jun to engage.
At that order, two HQ-91 missiles were fired from the destroyer Falin at the U-2R spy plane.
Mayday, mayday, Kelly is hit. Heading east.
No!
Radio transmission U-2 went dead.
Fuck!
Was all Cobb could say.
Patrick, let's get out of here.
A few more seconds and we should get all the ships near Davao Gulf, McClanahan replied. They'd flown over 100 miles farther west than they had planned, within 30 miles of the mouth of Davao Gulf itself. Suddenly, a yellow radar dome appeared right in front of the B-2 bomber icon on the SMFD. The dome instantly turned red.
Break right!
Patrick shouted as he hammered the chaff button for the left ejector rex.
Descend!
Cobb threw the big bomber into a 45-degree bank turn, letting the sudden loss of lift over the wings pull the nose down. He rolled wings level at 100 feet above the sea, just one wingspan above the dark waters below. Patrick could see traces lashing out into the darkness, firing at the chaff blob that he had just released.
Where the hell did he come from?
Fuck!
The terrain-following computer began to command a climb to clear the tall, spire-like mountains ahead, and the two crewmen could start to see the island on the forward-looking infrared scanner. Just then, on the infrared scanner, they could see a sharp flare of light, and the missile arced skyward, then heeled over and headed straight for them.
I see it! I see it! Cobb cried out. Stand by on flare's right!
As soon as the motor on the missile winked out, Cobb yelled,
No!
Then threw the B-2 bomber into a hard turn to the left. Simultaneously, Patrick pumped out flares from the right ejector, keeping his finger on the button. The missile passed directly over the cockpit, missing the Black Knight bomber by just a few scant yards.
Nuts to this, Cobb muttered. I'm getting out of here.
Cabin check complete, Patrick reported. Then, thanks, Henry. The only acknowledgement he got was two clicks on the interphone button. Santa Cruz Channel near the city of Zamboanga, the Philippines. Duty day aboard the Chinese Liberation Army Navy destroyer Hung Lung for the day watch and flagstaff began at 5 a.m.
Admiral's Yin Chief of Operations, Captain Sun Ji Guoming, bowed deeply as he began.
Sir, I am pleased to provide you with the following theater briefing summary at this time, updated as of 5 a.m. local time. The greatest threat to the Southern Philippines Task Force, in the estimation of our intelligence section, is the American Air Battle Force. Unverified reports from our patrols in the Philippine Sea say that the Americans might have sent B-2 bombers as well. By 5 a.m., the destroyers should be in place, and the LSTs will begin deploying landing craft,
Sun continued.
The landing should begin at 6 a.m. and should be complete by 11. Sometime tomorrow afternoon, perhaps earlier, Samar International Airport will be ours.
Excellent, Captain Sun, Admiral Yin said, bowing from the neck. I congratulate you and your staff for a well-organized plan, and I wish us all success. The White House Oval Office. The President of the United States had extended his hand to greet United Nations Ambassador Deborah O'Day as she walked into the Oval Office. But by some sort of sudden urge, he found himself giving her a cordial hug. You've had a hell of an ordeal, lady.
Dealing with the ASEA and representatives of the Chinese delegation has been tougher than getting kidnapped by Samar's rebels, O'Day admitted. Mr. President, I have been given a communique by the Chinese government.
Just as we thought, the president said wearily, China rejects our demands for an immediate withdrawal. From the front of his desk, the president withdrew a red-covered folder and opened it. Without further hesitation, the president signed the order and replaced the orders in the folder and resealed it. Wilbur Curtis was on the phone 30 seconds later to the National Military Command Center. Anderson Air Force Base, Guam. Patrick McClanahan awoke 30 minutes before his alarm rang, 2 hours before the first daily standby situation briefing. He needed rest, but he knew his mind was not going to let him have any more. McClanahan went immediately to the command post, waiting patiently as his ID was checked by the security guards. He went and checked into the room where the Pacer Sky satellite system had been installed.
Patrick, General Brad Elliott exclaimed as the young navigator bombardier walked in. Couldn't sleep, huh?
Patrick shook his head.
Henry either.
We got the order, didn't we? Patrick asked.
Couple hours ago,
Elliott said. McClanahan saw John Masters on the master console.
Dr. Masters, how are you doing?
Cool, Mac, my man, real cool,
Masters said. Is it back online, Dr. Masters?
Not quite,
Masters admitted.
But you gotta think positive. Hey, Mac, you ready to kick some Chinese butt out there tonight?
The name's McClanahan, Doctor. Lieutenant Colonel Patrick McClanahan. I don't like the way you were talking back there, Masters. I think you've got a big mouth.
Hey, I know you're a little nervous about maybe having to go on a mission tonight, but that's no reason.
You don't know anything about what's going on.
I know exactly what's happened. You guys are going to bomb the crap out of the Chinese Navy. I know you're going to do it, and I know what weapons you're going to use. I know what routes you'll fly.
Tell me this, Dr. Masters. Tell me who's going to die out there.
Masters thought a moment, then replied,
I estimate your losses at less than 5% of the duration of this conflict.
No!
I didn't ask you how many. I asked who.
Masters was finally silent.
Yeah, I know, Patrick said. I'm supposed to be the best, but it's bullshit. I know my ship, not lucky.
Yeah, well, listen to me.
A few years ago, I never gave a shit much about people either. I wasn't exactly what you'd call a team player. I did my job and went home. I hate to say it, but we were a lot alike back then.
Then what happened to you?
McClanahan's smile vanished.
Combat,
was all McClanahan said. And he turned and walked away. Chinese destroyer Jinan, south of Davao of the Philippines.
Sir, the destroyer Kaifeng reports one hit by a Tomahawk cruise missile. Kaifeng, radio for assistance. Task Force Group, Commander, dispatching frigate Ying Tan to assist. Destroyer Zunyi now reports under attack by sea-skimming anti-ship missiles. Patrol boat 6114 hit by harpoon anti-ship missile.
Emitters in standby,
the commander of the destroyer Jinan shouted.
Turn the radars off. Use all available personnel with infrared and electro-optical spotters. But find those bombers!
The nightmare was back. Only 2 days since first stirring up the hornet's nest with their reconnaissance overflight, McClanahan and Cobb were back at it again in their B-2 stealth bomber. McClanahan's B-2 had a few stings itself this time around. It carried 4 Tacit Rainbow cruise missiles and 4 HARM anti-radar missiles in its left bomb bay, plus a rotary launcher with 6 SLAM TV-guided missiles in the right bomb bay. Frigate Yingtan, 40 miles south of destroyer Jinan.
Bridge, CIC, multiple small targets within 5 miles, all bearings. Additional air targets, 2 large targets, in trail formation, bearing 278. Range to closest target, 10 nautical miles, radar down.
The commander was on the intercom immediately.
CIC, all 37 gun stations, fire defensive pattern, multiple inbound missiles, all quadrants. Attempt visual acquisition. Release radar decoys. Shut down all radars and verify.
The sudden flurry of gunfire into the night sky was spectacular and frightening at the same time. Cobb instinctively banked farther west to avoid the area where most of the gunfire was being concentrated.
Jesus Christ, McClanahan muttered.
It's not the guns I'm worried about, Cobb said. I'm waiting for the SAMs from that frigate.
He hit us with a radar sweep powerful enough to paint us, McClanahan said. I got a lock on a big mothership. That must be the frigate. Laser rangefinder on. Laser firing. McClanahan touched the right bomb bay icon on the bottom of his super multifunction display, and the weapons computer picked the SLAM TV-guided missile. Missile counting down. Missile one away. The right bomb bay door slid open, and the single CSRL launcher ejected a SLAM-guided missile into the slipstream. 7 seconds later, the launcher rotated and ejected a second missile. The ship's defensive guns successfully hit the first SLAM missile seconds before it hit, but the second SLAM missile was impossible to hit. It was all over the sky, skimming just a few meters above the water, and the guns could not keep up with it. The missile finally plowed into the starboard gunwale, just below the number 637mm gun turret. Good hit, Patrick, McClanahan cried out. One impact, only minor secondaries. Good hit, but no kill. Just then a missile warning light began to blink. The missile warning indication changed to a missile lock warning. Missile radar locked on, McClanahan shouted. Track breakers on. Descend and accelerate if possible.
Chinese destroyer Jinan.
Lock onto first air target.
The operator Jinan's aft HQ-91 missile fire control radar report.
Missile one away. Missile two.
Incoming missiles. High speed bearing 241 degrees.
Two AGM-84E SLAM missiles from the second B-2 Black Knight bomber in McClanahan's attack formation had detected the HQ-91 missile fire control radar and had homed in on it just after missile launch. But the SLAM missiles were big subsonic targets and easy for the destroyer to lock on radar. The vessel's guns began firing, and both SLAM missiles were destroyed well before they reached Jinan. But that left them vulnerable to two HARM missiles fired from McClanahan's B-2 bomber. The HARM missiles homed in precisely on the fore and aft radar dishes of the fog lamp fire control radars, hit and exploded. The results in the combat information center below decks were as disruptive as a nuclear blast. In just a split second, a 4,000-ton warship was rendered virtually impotent, but not totally.
Four missile salvo, shoot!
The second B-2 bomber had the unfortunate luck to make a slight right turn. The first HQ-91 missile streaked by just to the left of the bomber. But the second missile hit the Black Knight bomber on the left wing, turning the entire left side of the high-tech bomber into a huge yellow fireball in seconds.
Target hit!
A cheer went up in Jinan's combat information center, but it was very short-lived.
Incoming missiles! Multiple contacts! Altitude less than 50 meters! Speed 600 knots! So, Admiral Yin himself sends his compliments and advises you that Tomahawk missiles are your priority. Your personal priority.
Destroyer Hong Long, 60 miles west of the destroyer Jinan.
Report on the invasion force, Admiral, Yin ordered. Are they ready to land?
All vessels are in position,
Captain Sung reported.
It can no longer wait, Yin said. Order the landing craft to head ashore immediately.
But, sir, we have had no time to prepare the beachhead for our forces.
We may not have an hour before those bombers and cruise missiles are on top of them, Yin said. Issue the orders and get those Marines on the beach.
Sir, report from Rear Admiral Yan Lai.
Captain Sun Ji Guoming, the chief of operations for Admiral Yin Po Lun's flagstaff, said.
The amphibious assault has gone better than he has expected. The first landing craft are ashore with few casualties. The second wave will land in a few minutes.
As you were, Captain, Yin growled. The resistance so far is low, and the threat from American bombers is very high. Order the landing ships ashore immediately.
The updated NERTSAT data feed came in just as Cobb and McClanahan's B-2 crossed the coastline south of Kayaponga. On a super multi-function display, McConaughey could see the updated positions of three Tomahawk cruise missiles that were to go in ahead of his B-2 Black Knight bomber. McConaughey expanded his SMFB out to 60 miles range. At the top of the Northrop display was their primary target, the radar site on Mount Oppo. From that radar site, the Chinese could vector in fighters against every American bomber in the strike package. McConaughey immediately designated the top of the mountain as the target for two SLAM missiles. He had to program in a terminal pop-up maneuver for the missiles in order to hit the radar domes from above rather than from the side. Missiles programmed, Henry. Ready for launch. Fighters at 10 o'clock, 40 miles, McConaughey said. Two. Now showing six. At least six heading this way. I don't think they see us yet. Fighters, two separated from the rest of the pack, McConaughey shouted. 12 o'clock. X-band search radars. They might have spotted us.
We go west, then,
Cobb said. He banked his B-2 bomber hard to the left, scurrying across the wide valley for the relative safety of a hilly ridge. 15 miles until we reach that ridge, about 2 minutes, McConaughey reported.
Kong Yong, 1-7, hold your position,
the JS-7 pilot shouted.
Formation coming, right to intercept. Control, this is Delta. We have an American B-2 stealth bomber on radar, turning to intercept at this time.
But as they did, extremely heavy jamming from the B-2 bomber continually broke radar lock. Cobb had the power up to full military thrust, trying desperately to make it to the cover of the hills to the west. Fighters crossing behind us, McConaughey told him. They found us. Fighter radar's down now. They might be engaging visually or by IR. Bangoy Strait near Davao, Mindanao, the Philippines, that same moment. It was the largest concentration of Chinese warships since the Korean conflict, all concentrated within 10 miles of the city of Davao, and they were ready to begin their assault. I'm launching the SLAM missiles. At least we'll take out the radar before those bozos get us, McConaughey yelled. Cobb had to allow the bomber to climb an excruciatingly high 100 extra feet before the missiles could start their countdown.
Missile 1 counting down. Doors open. Missile 1 away. Missile 2 away. Doors closed. Descend back to 100 feet TFR.
Cobb and McConaughey started flying for their lives.
Missiles! Bomber launching missiles!
The Chinese A-5K pilot screamed. He selected a PL-2 heat-seeking missile and hit the launch button when the bomber was directly in front of him.
We're not going to find any place to hide in these hills here, Patrick said. Missile launch! Break right!
Patrick shouted. The laser jammer had locked onto the PL-2 missile and began bombarding it with high-energy laser light, instantly burning out the sensitive gallium arsenide eye and rendering the missiles useless. But Patrick couldn't celebrate yet. The Chinese fighter had launched a second missile, this time from even closer range.
Climb!
Patrick shouted, and he began pumping out flares as fast as he could. The tactic worked. The second missile lost the hot engine exhaust for a split second. PL-2's 28-pound warhead automatically detonated, but only 30 feet away from the B-2 bomber's left engine wing. The explosion sawed off 20 feet of the left inboard elevon, completely separating it from the bomber. The left wing dipped lower and lower, and there seemed nothing Cobb could do to stop it.
We're hit, the pilot screamed. Get on the controls, he called over to McConaughey. Get the left wing up.
McConaughey unstowed his side stick controller. He moved the grip, but nothing happened.
It's not active.
Cobb ripped off his oxygen mask and screamed,
Then get out, Patrick, get out!
Get the wing up, Henry!
Patrick yelled. Cobb took his left hand off the throttles and pushed on his control stick. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, the left wing seemed to rise, and Patrick decided right then and there that he was not going to eject.
Bring us right if you can, Patrick said. Mount Oppo is at our 2 o'clock position, 8 miles. It's our last hope, heading 035.
What do we do when we reach Mount Oppo?
Fly around it and pray, McConaughey said. It's our only hope of losing these jokers. Fast,
he called over to Cobb.
Fly right over the peak of Mount Oppo.
The B-2 bomber momentarily disappeared from the narrow field of view image on the low-light TV screen, and the pilot of the Chinese A-5K fighter bomber hurriedly expanded his screen and searched frantically for the intruder. The huge B-2 bomber made a sudden right turn at a very steep bank angle. The A-5 pilot simply pulled his nose around tighter. He closed, squeezed his gun trigger, and let the one-second burst rake the B-2 bomber's fuselage. And at that exact moment, two Tomahawk cruise missiles had actually flown over the two aircraft and had hit the Mount Oppo radar site just a few hundred feet away from the Chinese fighter. The explosion tossed the Chinese fighter bomber nearly a half mile sideways in the air, sending him crashing into the lush green valley below. The explosion at the Mount Oppo radar site rattled the B-2 bomber. Cobb lowered the big bomber's nose once again, trying to build up his waning airspeed and regain full control of the stricken bomber. And at that very instant, a very horrifying sight filled his screen, the sight of a large Chinese vessel only 10 miles ahead of them.
"Holy shit! We gotta get out of here!"
he shouted. "As long as we're here, let's start the party," McClanahan said dryly. Patrick quickly programmed his last two SLAM missiles on the fleet ahead of them, ran through the release checklist, and launched the missiles at the Chinese warships. The JS-7 pilot was more experienced in air-to-air engagements than his former leader. He switched the missile system to bore sight and kept his power high, closing the distance rapidly. It had to be led on target just like a gun, but that was easy in this case, since the B-2 wasn't maneuvering and seemed virtually incapable of doing so. But he never got to fire the missile. Two AIM-120 Scorpion missiles from Major Kelvin Carter's EB-52 Megafortress bomber ripped into the Chinese fighter, flinging it across the river valley below. "Keeping it coming to the right, horse," Major Carter told Cobb and McClanahan.
"Affirm, Diamond 1-3,
Cobb replied on the scrambled tactical frequency, recognizing Carter's voice.
"Thanks for clearing our tail."
"No problem. What's your situation?"
"Lost number one. Lost our primary hydraulics. Lost part of our left flight controls. Losing fuel out of the left wing," Cobb replied.
"We'll stay with you. We're out of air to surface stuff anyway."
"What's the status of the strike package?"
"We lost two buffs and one black knight going on, not counting you guys," Carter said. "The real fight should be starting right about now."
The President's Palace, Beijing, People's Republic of China.
"You will not capitulate to the Americans,"
Chinese High Central Qin Po Xiong said as he grabbed the phone from the foreign minister's hand. Qin shouted,
"We are hours away from final victory, Zhu Ti Yanbing. You told this government that we could expect 20-30% losses maximum throughout the duration of this conflict," Zhou argued. "You did not say we would sustain 30% losses in 3 hours.
Zhong ignored Qin. To his foreign minister, Zhong said, "Allah Zhu, I will speak with you for a moment." Qin was not invited on the brief discussion. Zhong said a few words to Zhou, who bowed deeply and hurried off. Mindanao, the Philippines. The vertical plot greaseboard in the flag bridge of the destroyer Hong Long was physically painful to look at. Fortunately, the attackers still had not reached the Marines on the beach.
"What escorts?"
Yin muttered.
"Son, we have lost 6 patrol boats, plus the Hong Long group."
"6 patrol boats?"
Yin said in a low, wavering voice.
"6. I began this operation with 8 destroyers, 20 frigates, and nearly 60 patrol boats."
"Son, enemy aircraft inbound from northeast of Davao,"
the radio man reported.
"What kind of aircraft are they?"
Sun ordered.
"The Admiral needs type of aircraft. Get it." "Aircraft in Eastern Group reported as B-2 aircraft only,"
the radio man replied after several inquiries.
"Issue an air defense alert to all vessels and all forces,"
Sun ordered.
"Have all forces take cover on the beach."
Admiral Yin looked as if he had been deflated with a knife. He could only stare at the vertical plot, muttering something to himself that Sun could not hear. 4 F-111G fighter bombers screamed into the area nearly at supersonic speed, right into the midst of the lines of landing craft trying to land their forces on the beaches south of Davao. Each carried fuel-air explosive canisters. Each Hades explosion was greater than the force of a 10,000-pound high-explosive bomb, creating a mushroom cloud of fire that stretched across the water for nearly half a mile, deafening or knocking soldiers unconscious. 2 of the Hades canisters sailed onto the beach, amid several companies of Chinese Marines, and the incredible force of the explosion was just as devastating on land. 2 minutes later, the heaviest armed warplanes in the entire battle began their assault. 6 B-1B bombers swooped in from the north at treetop level. They were never detected until it was far, far too late.
"Hong Long, this is Tiger. Hong Long, this is Tiger. How do you read?"
"It is Colonel Liu Yang," Captain Sun said excitedly. "I recognize his voice. He is the commander of the Northern Assault Force."
Then, to Yin's horror, he heard a voice in English.
This is Colonel Ronaldo Carigata, Admiral Yin, Acting Deputy Commander, Commonwealth of Mindanao Defense Force. Colonel Yu Jiang will not be giving any reports for quite some time. General Samar's forces still hold the airport and the city. Allah Akbar. Good day, Admiral Yin.
And the line went dead. Yin staggered back away from the radio man as if he'd been stung by the microphone. The Admiral's flagstaff watched as Admiral Yin Poldun withdrew his Type 54 7.62mm sidearm from his holster, placed the muzzle to his right temple, and calmly blew his brains out across his flag bridge. The People's Hall of Government, Beijing, China. Escorted by two aides and two soldiers, High General Qin Po Zhihong marched through the halls of the offices of the Premier of the People's Republic of China. General Qin bowed deeply from the waist. Comrade Premier, I am reporting as ordered.
Do you have a sense of support for me, General? Chung asked in a surprisingly strong, loud voice.
Comrade Premier, first I regret to inform you that the Honorable Commander of the People's Liberation Army, Navy, South Philippine Task Force, Admiral Yin Po Lun, died an honorable death while engaging enemy forces in the course of his duties to the people.
Very tragic, Chung said. He will be remembered as a loyal servant of the people of the Republic.
General Qin, the Foreign Minister, Zhu Tianbing, chimed in, would it be possible for your forces to safely disengage and withdraw to Puerto Princesa on the island of Palawan, or perhaps even to Nan Shadao?
Do not speak to me of withdrawal, Qin shouted.
But Qin turned his back and left.
If you leave now, General Qin, you leave as the former commander of the People's Liberation Army,
Foreign Minister Zhu said. The Politburo has already decided to open a dialogue with the Americans for an orderly withdrawal.
But he did not leave. Instead, he stepped towards the conference table and seated himself. Anderson Air Force Base, Guam.
Henry, Patrick, damn your hide, good to have you back, Elliot said. You brought back another bent bird, Patrick. This time the commendation will be public, nothing red-jacketed this time for both of you.
And how goes the war?
Elliot's face brightened a bit as he replied. Preliminary post-strike data is hard to believe. I mean, really hard to believe. It's too early to tell for sure, but we might have sunk or damaged as many as one-third of the damn Chinese Navy's destroyers.
McConaughey felt a tingle over his entire body when he heard the news. No matter how terrible war was, news of success on the battlefield was always welcome. So when do we go back out?
The Army might try an invasion of Davao in order to keep the Chinese ground troops from massing on Mindanao, Elliot added. I hope the politicians of Washington and Beijing get their acts together to call a halt to this thing right now.
That, Patrick McConaughey agreed, was every warrior's silent prayer. Go and get ready to fight, but hope like hell they don't have to.
Malacanang, Presidential Palace, Manila, Republic of the Philippines. The door to the rooftop helicopter landing pad burst open, and First Vice President Daniel Taguina rushed through the doorway.
But your helicopter is just arriving, Mr. President,
he heard a voice say. He turned and found General Jose Trujillo Samar himself standing before him.
Taguina said with a sneer, I see your time with your American friends has not helped to improve your looks, Samar.
Nor has your time with your Chinese friends improved your integrity, Samar responded. You will be taken into custody and tried by the Parliament and the Supreme Court.
Samar turned to watch as the helicopter that had been safely orbiting the rooftop now began its descent. When it landed, the left side door opened, and out stepped Arturo Micaso.
Taguina could not believe his eyes.
Hello, Daniel,
the Philippine president intoned.
Thank you for allowing us the use of your getaway helicopter.
But I thought you were dead.
After Taguina was led away, Micaso and Samar stood and faced each other. Samar wore an expressionless visage. Micaso a slight smile.
So, General Samar, are you happy to see me as well?
Why did you stay in custody so long?
Samar asked in a dark, menacing voice. The country has suffered much because of your silence.
I had a little choice in the matter, Jose, Picasso explained. The Chinese were trying to decide which way the wind was blowing before executing me for real. So, should we now expel all foreign military forces from our country, Jose?
Part of the problem in this country was that we excluded some but invited others, Samara said. Is one society more or less corrupting than another?
Interesting idea, Picasso said. Interesting.
What will you do with Taguina? Samara asked. Will you push for the gallows?
Good question, Jose. What would you do?
I do not think such blind idiocy deserves the gallows. The prison at Puerto Princesa should be an appropriate home for him for the rest of his life, Samar responded.
Good answer,
Picasso said. I have decided to advise the Parliament tomorrow morning that I will step down as president, and that you will serve out the remainder of my term. What do you think of that, Jose?
With characteristic calm, he nodded at Picasso and said with just a hint of a smile, I approve of your decision, Mr. President. Copyright 1991, Dove Audio Incorporated. If you would like to receive a Dove Audio catalog, please call 1-800-345-9945.